Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla about this whole budget fight, everything that's going on. Really, I guess my big question is, why'd you show up to work today? You didn't really have a voice. The budget that's been rammed through. No real input from Democrats. This is a Republican budget. This is their baby. They're going to sink or swim on this that they have passed. They are going to be the ones who reap either the benefits or what I'm seeing is the political firestorm that's going to come out of the massive increases in local property taxes and the massive cuts to education and social service programs across the state. This is their baby. There's no saying, oh, well, them too. No. This is the Republican baby. Just like on the national level, we'll see everything held up. It's their baby. So it'll be interesting to see what Representative Sterla has to say. In the second hour, we're going to talk with Luigi Borda. He's a guy who ran from Philadelphia to Harrisburg on Sunday, and along the way talking to people, saying, hey, you know what, this SB1, this voucher thing, this privatization scheme, this destruction of public education has to stop. And he's got some interesting thoughts. We'll talk about that. And also in the second hour, John Paul Smith, communications person over at the United Steelworkers Local 7-669, will be here to talk about the one-year anniversary of him and his coworkers being kicked to the curb by Honeywell. Out in Metropolis, Illinois, and, you know, some of the goings-on that's happened over the last year. Again, this is another example of how fractured and broken our labor laws are in this country. The fact of the matter is these workers, they wanted to sit down, they wanted to negotiate. Honeywell said, this is it, out the door, we're not talking to you anymore. So it'll be interesting to talk about that. But as I said, the Senate has passed the state budget, $27.149 billion. And what gets me, I got to be honest, 27.14. Corbett put the cap at 27.3. The Senate Republicans chose to take another $151 million away from education, you know, help for seniors, help for the disabled. They just decided, you know what, we're gonna one-up the governor. We're gonna one-up the gov. I'm just not getting that mentality. When you had the opportunity to say, okay, well, we can use that extra $151 million to help local communities, help schools, help hospitals, whatever, chose not to do it. Maybe some oversight with the EPA, chose not to do it. Now, the governor, he was saying, you know, we're not going to touch that $600 million in additional revenue that has come into the state. No, can't do that. Because that was just a blip. Just a blip. And you know what's great about this? He has banned me. He has banned me personally from his YouTube account, the Governor Unplugged YouTube page, for asking a very simple question, which is pretty much, could we spend our blip on the poor and elderly? That's what I asked, and I have been banned. I am no longer allowed on that page to express my opinion to the governor of the state of Pennsylvania. So here's the thing. I mean, and I'm going to ask it again. Why couldn't we use the blip that the governor said, well, it's just a one-time thing, just a blip? Why couldn't we use it now? Because what's going to happen now is we will see sacrifice. And this isn't going to be shared sacrifice. No, no. But sacrifice from those who are least able to shoulder that burden. There's no drilling tax. You saw that go down. There's no closure of the Delaware loophole. No, no. We want to make sure that our big companies can extract their profits from the state and can, you know, just basically funnel them through a P.O. box in a building in Delaware. No additional revenue streams. None whatsoever. All it was cut, 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 cut. And of course, handout after handout to corporate special interests. So I guess, you know, to use the, I wonder if the Bush banner is going to be used again. Mission accomplished. Way to go. Yeah. Is this the direction we want to take the state in, though? Do we want to see massive cuts to education? Do you want to see this privatization scheme go forward? Because understand, and we've talked about this at length in the past, there are some 3,300 schools in the state of Pennsylvania. They're saying that 144 of them are failing. So if you're looking at the numbers, 144 out of 3,300, are we going to destroy the entire system just for those 144? Or are we going to, with laser-like accuracy and precision, identify those 144 schools and do with them what we should do? A little additional help. Maybe longer school days, maybe weekend classes, maybe smaller class sizes, maybe, I don't know, maybe bring in the parents to help educate them a little bit. Because to me, it's a much bigger thing than just saying, well, you know, the school is failing. It's a societal problem. But you'll never hear that from the radical right. Never. And for me, this whole SB1 thing is just, we don't know what else to do. So let's just destroy it so we don't have to be responsible for it anymore. That's where this is going. And it's, you know, it's an awful shame. But something did pop up today. And I was talking with someone about the House Republican leaders calling up Senate Bill 303 for second consideration. What this does, and it's amazing to me, that they're talking about setting up some of the Marcellus Shale impact fees. And what the bill does is it actually repeals some of the existing language to clean up sites that have hazardous material on them. It actually makes things worse. Now, they couldn't get it done today, but it does so much to really undo what little regulation is out there. And I love the fact that, you know, they're out there kind of pushing this, saying, well, we're gonna help these, you know, these areas that are affected by giving them the ability to go out there and do this stuff so we don't have to expose our governor. Because Governor Grover Norquist, the appointed governor, I guess, has said no new taxes because our governor was dumb enough to sign a pledge. You know, it's kind of like, you know, going down to the crossroads and you signed your soul away to the devil. And now the devil, he's got the piece of paper. We are basically being held hostage by the devil, which means no new revenue, which means that poor people are going to suffer. Children are going to be left in larger classes. And we're going to have massive pain across the working class of this country and this state. And still, we are not, under any circumstances, going to bring in any additional revenue, especially when you look at the Marcellus Shale. Now, I'm against the impact fee thing. I think it's stupid. But this is what the Republicans want to push. You know, we got to get it at the local level. And I find it absolutely amazing that they've done some of the things. Well, we've got to make sure that the local level has their ability to do what they want to do with their money, yet they want to impose on the city of Harrisburg a state solution to Harrisburg's problems. I just find that pretty, and I wish someone would explain it to me why the state has decided that they're going to impose that. I mean, it really is a complete violation of their ethos, a complete violation of their worldview. But never mind, don't have to answer for them, because they're not going to answer for themselves. And other big news, the governor did sit down, had a huge victory today, Jake. He signed off the Castle Doctrine, a whole big display, a whole big ceremony. It was wonderful. So now I can shoot people that I think are threatening me, I guess. I guess that's the take.
Does that mean we're going to turn into Pennsylvania?
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things that just makes you go, really? Is this where we're going?
I'm not one to take away Second Amendment rights. I'm not that far left. However, did we really need this bill? Was it other than a political tool that certain people use to get reelected? You know, part of me says that's all it was. Did we really need it? I'm not so sure about that.
So we'll see. I mean, you know, at the end of this, we'll see what happens. Hopefully, nothing happens, and we go along our merry way, and I don't get shot by anyone deciding they want to go after someone else. Because that's kind of what frightens me, that you're going to have this situation where two idiots are going to go at it, and they're, yeah, you threatened me, and then they start throwing shots at each other. And I'm walking by minding my own business, and I take one between the eyes. That's what worries me. And, you know, as you move down the road here, and this whole Castle Doctrine thing, it's scary on so many levels. Because I understand, look, trust me, if you listen to the name, the Castle Doctrine, I get it. Someone breaks into my house, I should have the right to shoot them. They have no right being in my house. Not once, get the castle idea. But if I'm, you know, just out in the parking lot somewhere, I don't know. If I've got an opportunity to escape, I mean, look, I understand. If your life's in danger, you do what you got to do. I'm never gonna say that you didn't have the right to defend yourself. But I listened to that clip of Joe Horn, where he's in his house. Someone's robbing the house next door. He's called the police. He got his gun, went outside, shot two people in the back. Sorry, I don't know that I'm in favor of that. Not whatsoever. Because he wasn't in danger. He chose to chose to put himself in the middle of that situation. And I don't want vigilantes. I don't want judge, jury, executioner. You know, at the end of this, look, I'm in favor of people having their guns and, you know, having your fantasies about people breaking into your house. I know I've heard them all. But at the end of the day, I don't want a bunch of Wyatt Earps. I don't want a bunch of Paul Revere's galloping down the street firing warning shots. I still can't get over that.
Anything, was he right?
He was charged. He was found not guilty because of the law. I mean, they have a law similar to this one. They have the ability. And look, you know, I've got friends who live in Texas, and they say, well, you know, he was protecting his neighbor's property. It's very much a mentality, and I don't know that I have that mentality. If somebody breaks in my house and stealing some stuff, you know, you call the police, you do that, but don't interject yourself into a situation where, A, you could end up dead, and B, you have that situation. Wow. What I wondered is what happened when the cops rolled up, and there he is standing with a shotgun.
It's hard for me to believe he couldn't have shot him in the leg or winged him and kept him there.
Wow.
That's my problem.
Here again, you don't shoot anybody with the intention of winging them. That's my belief. You're going to pull out a gun and you're going to shoot somebody. You better do them.
Well, if you're shooting him in the back, you're shooting to kill. And that's my problem with it.
Anyway, that's my take. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania State Representative Mike Sterla about this whole budget thing. And remember, as I've said a number of times, this is the Republican baby. Everything in this is theirs. They own it. We're right back after this. We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the
airwaves. Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. In stark contrast to Wisconsin Democrats, New Jersey's Democratic State Senate President Steve Sweeney, several Democratic state senators, and about a third of Democrats in the state House led a betrayal of working families to help Republicans gut public worker collective bargaining in New Jersey. Barbara Kasichian is president of the New Jersey Education Association. She told WBAI's Building Bridges program that the Democrats helped impose staggering new costs on public workers while violating collective bargaining rights and defeating a millionaire's tax that would have spread the sacrifice.
This bill increases worker contributions to the pension plan by 40% while eliminating cost of living adjustments for retirees for 30 years. And then in addition to it, it eliminates collective bargaining over health care and imposes enormous increases in the cost of health care, between 300 and 500% increases for health care. The vast majority of the Democrats are opposing this, but we have this group of Christiecrats who are doing this, and they are unraveling collective bargaining. It's the only state in the country where Democrats are in the lead in trying to unravel public worker collective bargaining. It's shameful.
35,000 Ford workers want their grievances over reinstatement of merit pay and 401k matches to be settled before they vote on any new contract later this year. The UAW is working with Ford on the grievance signed by the workers. Non-union salaried workers got their merit pay reinstated along with 401k matches in 2010, but hourly workers didn't. The workers say that violates the existing contract. The National Labor Relations Board is holding hearings July 18th and 19th in Washington, D.C. on proposed new rules that would speed up union representation elections. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka calls the proposed rules changes a common-sense approach to clean up an outdated system. Unions have long wanted faster NLRB elections because anti-union businesses often use delaying tactics and intimidation campaigns to scare workers out of supporting unions. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says with the unprecedented assaults this year on workers' rights in states across the country, the NLRB is taking a positive step for workers who want to exercise their fundamental rights to decide for themselves whether to form a union. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Again, as I said earlier, I have been banned from commenting on the Governor Unplugged YouTube video. Again, like I said, for simply asking the question. Could we, spend that blip, that little bit of money, that $600 million on helping the poor and helping the elderly, maybe a little education, a little help. Maybe defray some of these massive cuts. Maybe just a little bit, Could we just do that a little bit? But all I heard, from our governor was, read my lips. No new revenue. And again, our governor has threatened to veto any levy on Marcellus Shale drillers at all. We're going to veto it. That's it. Game over. Even though you got 70% of the people in this state, 70% who believe taxing the drillers is absolutely the right thing to do. And our governor and his multi-million dollar campaign cash donors, they say no. And the governor appointee, Grover Norquist, says no. And what's interesting to me is I think the drillers want to be taxed. so that they can get out of the spotlight. They can just go, you know, stage left, exit stage left, and go about, you know, raping and pillaging like they're supposed to do. You know, suck all of the gas out of the ground, contaminate the water, do all that stuff. Anyway, our governor has taken nearly $1 million from the drillers, and despite the polls, you've got all these, some 70% who support the severance tax. And again, not going to do it. And I like Senator Daylon Leach's take on it. He says, you know what, it's kind of like, you know, a father going home and saying, sorry, you know, times are tough. We're going to cut down to 2 meals a day, no new shoes. We're going to use electricity in one room of the house. You know, all of these cuts. You know, we're only going to take cold showers. That's it. Game over. No more hot water. We're going to use sticks out in the backyard to light a fire. No more gas. No more of that. And I am absolutely not going to go out there and work overtime. I'm not going to take a second job. I am in no way going to ask my employer for a raise. If I find money on the street, I will step over it. I mean, that's kind of what, and he's right. He's spot on. And it's absolutely ludicrous that you have a governor and a Republican legislature who has decided that it doesn't matter. We've got our fingers in our ears, our eyes are closed, not happening. We are not raising any additional revenue. Sorry. Gotta live within our means. Well, our means have another $600 million that you didn't plan on, that you didn't know. It's just plain nuts. So education is gonna suffer. Maybe not as bad as the governor wanted, $1 billion cuts from K-12 education. Maybe not as bad as he wanted for higher ed, 56%, but you're going to see cuts. And what does that mean? That means that you and me, we're going to pay higher property taxes. That means when my kids go to college, they're going to pay higher tuition, they're going to be indebted longer. That's what that means. The social services that we depend on, and there are people who depend on it, through no fault of their own, through just bad health, through, you know, whatever the cause, these people need our help. Those are going to be cut. And, you know, every step of the way, if you go back to that House Bill 916, the unemployment bill that Scott Perry wanted to ram through, the whole idea is we were going to save money by lowering benefits and making it harder to access the programs. So what does that mean? Well, that means that the people who need the programs will not get them. And they will not be able to sustain. And I guess that's part of the whole desperation class idea. This whole idea that if we make people desperate enough, and you go to Michelle Bachmann who says, oh, we should get away with the minimum wage. So, you know, if people want to work for $1 an hour, take full employment. And I guess if you create enough desperation, maybe you will get down to that. Maybe you will get down to $1 an hour. Maybe you will get down to 50 cents an hour. And the other part of this is the defunding of the EPA. You know, they're taking funds away at a time when we need it the most. When you need people saying, what's going on over there? What's that thing you're sticking in the ground? We think they're going to somehow police themselves. And look, understand the basic premise of business is to make a profit. Cut every corner you can possibly cut to maximize every bit of profit opportunity. That's just the nature of the game. That's the reality. You know, if you didn't have officials on the football field, how often do you think the offensive lineman would hold? If there were nobody calling fouls during a basketball game, how many times do you think LeBron James would go up and the center would punch him in the mouth? I mean, stop and think. If you've got nobody holding everyone accountable to some rules, to some basic rules, what do you think would happen? Well, you're going to have chaos. And at the end of it, who pays in this situation? You do. And I do. We get methane-filled water. We get bad air. We get soil that's contaminated. And they leave. You know, the majority of the companies that are drilling in this state are not from this state. They're from Texas. They're from Denver. They're from Akron, Ohio, surprisingly. They're from everywhere but here. And that should worry every one of us. And this budget, again, you know, I hate to harp on the fact that this is the Republican wet dream. This is the business wet dream. This is what they've wanted. They have turned this into truly a business-friendly desperation class state, Jake, where now you're going to have a class of people who they are going to push into the grinder.
Well, but apparently you don't understand. The governor's really doing us a favor because he wants these natural gas companies to move their headquarters here. Yeah. That'll happen. All you folks out there, stand by your phone, and we'll call you when that happens.
No, just take a deep breath and hold. We'll get back to you.
That ain't going to happen.
You know, you look at where did Halliburton move their world headquarters? Anybody know where Halliburton's world headquarters is? It used to be in Houston. They moved to Dubai. Why? Get away from taxes. You look, no matter how low your tax rate is, it's never low enough for them. GE had a zero tax rate. In fact, we gave them money, and that wasn't low enough for GE. We've given them a boatload of money. They're in the negative range. I think they would like to go at further negative. And that's kind of how this whole thing works. For me, you know, you spend money to create jobs. And in the states that have followed this slash and burn, of which we are now going to be one of them, the states that went down the path of slash and burn have created the least amount of jobs. They're the ones who are losing jobs. And I look at this budget and I ask the question, is Pennsylvania next? Are we going to be, because understand, we did okay during the recession. We lost a lot of jobs, but not nearly as much as the southern states. You look at South Carolina, you look at Florida, just completely destroyed. Michigan, completely destroyed. And what they do? Now we're going to this tax and this slash and burn mentality. And again, not creating the jobs. So it's going to be interesting to see where we take this and now what happens. But what I want you to remember, this day, this is the day the Republicans said, you know what, this is our baby. 27.149 billion dollars they've spent. When Corbett said you can go all the way up to 27.3, they chose, no, we're going to be better than you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, talk a little bit about health care and your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this. Okay.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
17th century playwright William Congreve must have been a seer, for he wrote that even in hell, there is no fury like a woman scorned. Apparently, he foresaw the tempest now roaring out of the League of Women Voters. Long considered to be the church ladies of American politics, the group is best known for its sober voter education efforts. But, pow! The ladies have suddenly shattered that stereotype by delivering a powerful political punch to a couple of U.S. senators, making clear to a startled Washington that they are not to be trifled with. LWV recently ran some hard-hitting TV ads taking Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown and Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill to task for trying to weaken enforcement of clean air laws. "I was shocked," cried McCaskill. "To me, they have always been about civic engagement and debates." Well, hello, Senator. You've just been civically engaged by a group of feisty women who realized that their polite and earnest letter-writing efforts to lawmakers like you were not working. With both parties kowtowing to the money of corporate polluters, senators were simply ignoring the letters. So the group toughened up. Senator Brown whined that LWV's ad was an ambush, as though the little ladies should stick to their inoffensive knitting. Pathetically, he tried to retaliate with an impetuous video slapping at the women's credibility, whimpering that they, quote, have gone to the gutter with their negative ads. Get a grip, Scott. You voted to gut EPA's Clean Air Authority, so it's hardly gutter politics for a group of mothers and grandmothers to point that out to voters. You've also taken campaign cash from the lobbyists with whom you voted, so it's your credibility that's in question. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking that senators are shocked when they're called to account by fed-up voters like the League of Women Voters. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You better surrender. Well, at least that's what the Republicans are saying. You better surrender to Democrats, or we're going to destroy the country. We're going to drive this right into the ditch. Part of the whole staged. Again, that whole thing with Cantor was staged. Him storming out of the meeting and making a big statement, I couldn't take it anymore. Staged. They planned it for weeks. Shows you how much the idiot doofus base understands. And you know, you talk about policy, you talk about the direction that the Republicans have taken this country. And really the conservative Democrats as well. I mean, there's a number of conservative Democrats that I could really do without. Max Baucus being right up at the very top. You go back to that healthcare discussion, and Baucus, you know, pretty much screwed it up from the very beginning. We could have had a system where we decided that, you know what, we want to be like Ben Franklin. We want preventative care and prevention, you know, ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. Remember that? Nope. We got to keep our reactive healthcare system. Got to make sure that those profits are made. Anyway, a new study titled Falling Behind Life Expectancy in U.S. Counties from 2000 to 2007 was conducted by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. It found that most counties in the United States, their people are dying sooner. Countries like Japan, countries like Canada, a number of other nations around the globe, they're seeing life expectancy growing. They're seeing their citizens living longer year after year after year. We, on the other hand, pretty much, I guess, depending on where you live and your gender, we are not. Women doing much worse than men. No real surprise there. Also, no surprise that people in Appalachia, the Deep South, and northern Texas also live shorter lives. Some interesting numbers from the report. More than 80% of counties fell in standings against the average of the 10 nations that were looked at. So now you've got the 10 best nations with life expectancy doing better than 80% of the counties in this country. Dr. Charles Murray, he's the director of this group that did the paper, one of the co-authors, he said, we're finally able to answer the question of how the U.S. fares in comparison to its peers globally. He says, despite the fact that the U.S. spends more per capita than any other nation on health, 8 out of every 10 counties are not keeping pace in terms of health care outcomes. That, he says, is a staggering statistic. Now, you look at this, and this is a little hard to follow, but the life expectancy in U.S. counties range from being 16 calendar years ahead to more than 50 years behind for women, and for men it's 15 years ahead to 50 years behind. That means that in some counties in this country, we've got a life expectancy that dates back to the 1950s with some of these other countries. We have some places that are going way back. Now, I got to question the idea behind this study, because they're saying, well, you know, These low life expectancies, it's not explained by the size of the nation. It's not racial diversity, not that. It's not economics. They said it's because of high rates of obesity, tobacco use, and preventable risks for an early death. Yet, the examples that they give, Mississippi, five counties in Mississippi had the lowest life expectancy for women, somewhere around 74 years old. Four counties in Mississippi, Humphreys County, Mississippi, has the lowest life expectancy in the country for men, 67 years old. That puts them behind Brazil, Latvia, and the Philippines. Now, you look at this and you go, okay, well, you know, Mississippi, you know, one of the poorest states in the country. How can economics not play into this? And then you look at the place where people are living longer, Collier, Florida, a very affluent area, average age 86 years old. Fairfax County, Virginia, another very affluent area, over 81 years. And you go down the list, every one of the ones that they point are affluent areas. The ones that aren't doing so well, poor areas. So to me, clearly, there is a correlation in economics. Of course, black men and women have lower life expectancies than white men and women. That we knew. Life expectancies for black women range between 69 and 82, and for black men, 59 to 77. Again, kind of, for me, it's the poverty thing. So as you're looking at this, you go down the list and you see, what aren't we doing? There's opportunity here, and the report says, you know, there are things we should be doing. And this Dr. David Fleming, the director of health at Seattle and King County, says, quote, it's not healthcare, it's not the healthcare system that is having the biggest impact on health. It's the community. He says the average person in the U.S. spends 1 hour annually in a physician's office unless they're really sick. And he's saying, so until we start moving our interventions out into the communities where people live, we're not going to get ahead of these problems. And it's kind of what I've been saying from the beginning. You've got to go back to the idea of preventative medicine, where people, you know, go to the doctor because it's time. Every year I go get a blood test, check my cholesterol, check, you know, all that stuff. You know, blood levels, sugar levels, you know, all of that stuff. Most people don't. You know, most people only go when, and I gotta be honest, I'm one of the people who only go when I'm dying or for my yearly physical. Should go more often. And you should have that relationship. But here's the thing. You know, here in this country, healthcare is that thing that either you have or you don't. And if you don't have it, you're not in the middle class. You cannot possibly. And I look at this story, that came across my desk by a guy named Steve Stevenson. Guy got sick. He was worked all his life. Got sick in Arizona. Was told he had to quit his job. Did that. Followed the doctor's orders. Doctor said, "Hey, you can't work. You can't be stressed out. You're gonna die. You're gonna have a heart attack and you're going to die." So he quits his job. Guess what? He doesn't qualify for the state's Medicaid program. He can get no health care through the Arizona health care cost containment system. Nothing. You know why? Because of the Social Security that he gets, he makes $12 too much. $12. So this guy is going on down the road, down, he's going to die. This is going to kill him. For $12. $12. And my question in this is, the longer we wait, and it's just like your car, when that little red light comes on, that's an indicator. That's to say, hey, idiot, take a look at me. Go do something. If you just put a piece of duct tape over that, I don't want to see that light anymore. You're on the road to some serious, serious problems. Same thing with this guy. You know, he needs help. We're not going to give it to him, so what's going to happen down the road? It's either going to kill him or it's going to cost us a lot more. Because we just don't get it, Jake. We just don't seem to have it in our minds that, you know what, sometimes it's easier to catch things early and to fix them than it is to just keep pushing them off down the road. Joe Lieberman, one of the, again, you know, I look at Trader Joe and I just have to be honest. One of these guys that I really, really could do without. He is now giving the Republicans basically a get out of jail free card on this Ryan Medicare Medicaid plan. I mean, he's really now setting it up Because at the end of the day, if the Democrats cave on this, and for all indications they're going to, and they allow the cuts to Medicare and allow the cuts to Medicaid, it's no longer going to be a campaign issue. Just like the Republicans did with the Bush slash Obama tax cuts. Because that's how they're framing this. You know, because Obama agreed to it, you know, those are Obama's tax cuts now. And you know what? They got a point. He should have taken the stand. Well, our buddy Trader Joe, along with Republican Tom Coburn, they've come out with a bill to cut $600 billion over 10 years from Medicare, along with raising, and they, you know, they got that on their brain. We're going to raise the age for everything. They're going to increase monthly premiums for the folks who are on it in the Medicare Part B. They're going to do that by 2% for 5 years, each year for 5 years. They're going to make folks making more than $150,000 a year and couples with more than $300,000 pay their full Part B. I'm in favor of that. They're going to make one deductible for both Medicare Part A, which covers hospitalization, and Part B, which covers doctor's visits. So you're going to have one deductible. They're also going to increase the age from 65 to 67 by 2025 and patch up some of the rate schedules. And, you know, I look at this and I go, really, is this this is our guy? This is Trader Joe doing us in? And I'm frustrated by the whole surrender mentality. This really, honestly and truthfully, is a major issue that they're not. They're not going to let us live down if they go and do this.
And I don't believe he's running for re-election, so there's even less political leverage on him.
I don't know. Anyway, you know, it's one of those things that drives me nuts. And they're going to give on this. New Jersey, you've got the state lawmakers going, hey, we need to stop Christie's Medicaid cuts. And look, it's just nuts. They want to cut $300 million in the state's Medicaid program. So how many people like that Steve Stevenson in Arizona are going to die in New Jersey now because you've got this guy who says, you know what, we're not going to tax the millionaires and billionaires. No. We are going to make sure... We're going to make sure that those poor people pay their freight. Just nuts. Anyway, let's go to the phones. I got Helen on line one. How are you doing tonight, Helen?
Hi. I just want to talk about your girlfriend, Michelle Bachman.
Oh, I love Michelle Bachman.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I used to work for Children and Youth, and I just heard, you know, I'm a little behind everything, that she had 23 foster children, all teenage girls. Allegedly because she was helping them with bulimia, counseling them and all that stuff. Well, her last child was born, I guess, 93, 94. I mean, I wonder how many of those children, since she had them from 92 to 2000, were babysitters. And I wonder if anybody's going to do a FOIA to find out how much money she was making with these children, because I know a lot of people, social workers and other people, they get whole bunches of these teenage kids, and they get anywhere from $400 to $700 a month per child.
Yeah, I've heard upwards of $800, $900 as well. Yeah, that's a good question, and one that I had never thought of.
I did because I was with Victims of Child Abuse Laws for many years, and, you know, I did. How I got the job with children and youth, I will never know, but it gave me an insight into what people who have their children taken away were talking about, because oftentimes they take a child who is not really being abused and who is a well-behaved child because they're easier to place and somebody can make a lot of money. We had a woman from Tressler Lutheran. She was the social worker, and she had 5 kids at a time. That's, you know, figure 5 times 5. And they were teenagers. How much work do you have to do to take care of teenagers?
It depends on how involved you are in it.
I
remember.
Most of them were well-behaved children, and I don't know. One boy was I guess he was a Vietnamese child that had come here and didn't have any family here because they were, you know, separated or something. in during the war, but, you know, that's the kind of kids she took care of. So I'm thinking that Michelle is a real hypocrite, and, you know, I was raised Lutheran, so I know that if she was getting these children from a Lutheran service, they weren't kids like we have in the system in that the state has.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I got to be honest, one of the few things that I do give her credit for is that she did take those kids into her home. I do give her credit for that, but it's an interesting question. How much did she profit from it?
Because I worked for children and youth upwards of 6-7 years and saw this. And like I said, I was a member of Victims of Child Abuse Laws and how these people go after children that maybe aren't really abused, or the family may have problems because they were homeless or they didn't have a job for a while. And instead of helping the family, they pay, like I said, upwards of $500-$700 to put them in somebody else's home instead of giving it to the parents to help them.
Yeah, well, that's something else to look at. It's a whole different scenario. But I appreciate the thoughts, Helen. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, again, you know, you look at this, and one of the things, I got to be honest, I do, you know, aside from what the points that Helen made, one of the few things that I give Bachman credit for is the fact that she did take these kids in. But now, you know, thinking about it in the terms that she threw it out there, I got to wonder now, you know, because 23 kids, her husband runs a clinic, how much of that was bringing in new business? I don't know. But I'll guarantee you one thing. The national media will figure this out and we'll sort it out. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So here's the thing. AccuWeather is reporting that this spring has broken records in the amount of damage that has happened, has been caused by severe weather so far this year. They're saying damage in the range of $21-22 billion. And if you look at the whole cost of the whole spring, $28 billion, somewhere between $23-28 billion, it's going to cost us, which they're saying is three times the operating budget of the Environmental Protection Agency. And when I heard that, I said, well, you know what? For the right, this is a perfect opportunity to say, so we need to get rid of the EPA in order to pay the costs. Perfect Republican way of thinking. We have a disaster. Cannot let a good crisis go to waste. And they've been railing about getting rid of the EPA for years. So now that we have all of this disaster, all of this flooding, all of these tornadoes, all of this stuff that is, you know, just ripped through this country. You look at from Illinois to Louisiana, the flooding in the Mississippi, they're saying it's going to cost upwards of $2 billion. In one town in North Dakota, it's talking about $90 million just in the preliminary estimates of the flood they had there just to the public facilities. That's not the private stuff. That's not personal homes and all of that. You look at all of this money that we need to rebuild. When we had not invested in better levees, we had not invested in how to protect ourselves, build homes that are going to withstand. No, what we do is in the areas that are susceptible to tornadoes and hurricanes, we build houses out of bubble gum and barbed wire. We build it out of, you know, like sheets of paper and some bubble gum. We use plastic garbage bags and, you know, and just little tiny sticks and some twigs off the tree. I guess we didn't learn from the three pigs, because in the areas that have the worst weather, we build the shoddiest buildings. And I guess part of it for me goes back to most of those are right-to-work states, no building codes, they're liberty states, as they like to say, and no building codes, no real construction, movement, I guess. So they throw up these shoddy shacks, and now it costs us every year. Rebuild every year. They're saying upwards of $28 billion. So you look at this and you go, this is a good example of disaster capitalism. It's going to help things move forward. Much like they're trying to do with the debt. Again, good crisis, can't let a good crisis go to waste. If we can cause a collapse, if we can cause a disaster, if we can just push our scorched earth policy through, we're going to be able to benefit from this. And what gets me is right now they're saying, well, whoa, the debt's too high. Oh, geez. Oh, we can't raise the debt ceiling. Oh, geez. Oh, it's horrible. Things are just going to fall through the floor. Oh, my God, we're in big trouble. But yet when George W. Bush was president, House Minority Leader at the Minority Leader at the time, Boehner, Eric Cantor, Mitch McConnell, John Kyle, the very ones who right now are saying, oh, the sky's going to fall, they were part of raising the debt limit nearly $4 trillion. Because remember, when the Shrub took office, when he was appointed president, we were at $5.95 trillion and going down. Alan Greenspan was saying, oh, we don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea. We're paying the debt off so fast. No idea. Well, Shrub comes in, hands out a bunch of money. We got big problems. So when the Shrub left office with nearly a $10 trillion debt and a $1.2 trillion deficit, a nice gift for whoever the next president, the next lucky winner of the 2008 presidential election was, that $1.2 trillion deficit, that was their baby as well. In this case, Obama won. But it could have been McCain. But it didn't matter. 2009, that debt was going to be over $11 trillion. That's what the Shrub did. So you go back and you go, well, how many times did we raise the debt ceiling under the Shrub? Because during that time period, we had to because, we need the economy to grow and we need to be able to borrow this money to fight our wars and to fund our tax cuts and to make sure that the very wealthy keep getting our checks. Remember? You got to do it. June 2002. They approved a $450 billion increase, jump it up to $6.4 trillion. Kyle was the only one who voted against it. McConnell, Boehner, Cantor, all in favor. May 2003, jumped it up another $900 billion. $7.384 trillion. All four of them. All four of them voted for it. On the very same day that they're raising the debt ceiling by $900 billion, they're handing out $350 billion to their wealthy buddies. Borrowed and handed over. That's the Republican way of doing things, after all. Give me a tax and spender any day. At least we're paying our bills. You remember Cheney? Remember what Dick Cheney said? Reagan taught us deficits don't matter. Deficits don't matter. So that was their mantra. That's what they did. Fast forward, November 2004, Congress approved another $800 billion, taking our debt ceiling up to $8.1 trillion. All four of them, Boehner, Cantor, Kyle, McConnell, all in favor. The ayes have it. March 2006, Congress again approved a $781 billion increase in the debt levy, almost to $9 trillion. Did I hear any nays? No, all four, the ayes have it. September 2007, another $850 billion increase. And again, the ayes have it, all four of them. Now that Obama's in office, because we had no problem raising the debt ceiling when the little shrub was there, because the money was going to their people. It was going to the very wealthy. It was going to the defense contractors. It was going to the investor class. Now that we've created some of this additional debt, which I'm not in favor of massive debt like this, but we're in a recession. We're in bad times. But now that some of that money is trickling down, you know, building roads and bridges and maybe talking about, a rail and maybe some alternative energy, now it's, we can't do this. Sorry, black guy in the White House. We just can't raise it. It's against our conscience. We, the four of us. I mean, are you getting this? I mean, it's amazing to me. Now, stop and think about the money that we borrowed. We borrowed all this money under the shrub, under Bush and the whole TARP thing and all that. We handed $10 billion to Goldman Sachs. Here, Goldman, $10 billion. You know what they just did? They just announced they're firing 1,000 workers in the U.S., and they're moving those jobs to Singapore. And remember a couple weeks ago I talked about Judd Gregg, the former senator from New Hampshire, being one of their quote-unquote international advisors and how something hanky was coming up? Well, now we know. He was the cover for those 1,000 jobs going to Singapore. He was the cover for Goldman Sachs wanting to cut $1 billion in operating costs over the next year. Here's the big secret, though. First quarter of this year, $2.7 billion in their pocket profit. And they want to cut another $1 billion. Why? They want more. So now Goldman Sachs is right there with GE and Chevron and Intel and all of those other big multinational corporations who have outsourced some 2.5 million jobs in the past 10 years. You're not getting this? And you look at what's going on down in Florida. Rick Scott yesterday signed this crappy bill into law, draconian bill, cutting Florida's unemployment compensation system from 26 weeks down to 12. And just like our buddy Scott Perry's 916 here in Pennsylvania, that almost became law here, it makes getting those benefits nearly impossible. And according to the National Employment Law Center, this law, Florida will go further than any state in the country in dismantling its unemployment insurance system. So good luck, buddies. You workers, you're on your own. Goldman Sachs, here's $10 billion. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
In stark contrast to Wisconsin Democrats, New Jersey's Democratic State Senate President, Steve Sweeney, several Democratic state senators, and about a third of Democrats in the state house led a betrayal of working families to help Republicans gut public worker collective bargaining in New Jersey. Barbara Kasichian is president of the New Jersey Education Association. She told WBAI's Building Bridges program that the Democrats helped impose staggering new costs on public workers while violating collective bargaining rights and defeating a millionaire's tax that would have spread the sacrifice.
This bill increases worker contributions to the pension plan by 40% while eliminating cost of living adjustments for retirees for 30 years. And then in addition to it, it eliminates collective bargaining over health care and imposes enormous increases in the cost of health care, between 300 and 500% increases for health care. The vast majority of the Democrats are opposing this, but we have this group of Christiecrats who are doing this, and they are unraveling collective bargaining. It's the only state in the country where Democrats are in the lead in trying to unravel public worker collective bargaining. It's shameful.
35,000 Ford workers want their grievances over reinstatement of merit pay and 401k matches to be settled before they vote on any new contract later this year. The UAW is working with Ford on the grievance signed by the workers. Non-union salaried workers got their merit pay reinstated along with 401k matches in 2010, but hourly workers didn't. The workers say that violates the existing contract. The National Labor Relations Board is holding hearings July 18th and 19th in Washington, D.C. on proposed new rules that would speed up union representation elections. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka calls the proposed rules changes a common-sense approach to clean up an outdated system. Unions have long wanted faster NLRB elections because anti-union businesses often use delaying tactics and intimidation campaigns to scare workers out of supporting unions. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says with the unprecedented assaults this year on workers' rights in states across the country, the NLRB is taking a positive step for workers who want to exercise their fundamental rights to decide for themselves whether to form a union. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, over the weekend, on Sunday, I got a story of a guy running from Philadelphia here to Harrisburg, to bring awareness to this whole privatization scheme, this whole, what I'm saying is the destruction of public education, this idea that there are 144 schools that are quote-unquote failing out of 3,300, and we need to destroy the whole system to bring those up. Seems kind of dumb to me, but that's what our Republican-led legislature wants to pursue. There's been a lot of pushback, and hopefully we'll be able to continue that pushback, because I understand tomorrow they're going to be talking about it on the floor. But I've invited Luigi Borda. He's the guy who ran from Philadelphia to Harrisburg, arrived on Sunday about 5 o'clock from his grueling run. Luigi, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I guess the first most obvious question is why run, and what did you get out of it?
Well, and it's funny. About a month ago, I started running about 5 years ago, and I was doing a run. And as we often do, we talk about a lot of different subjects, and we started talking about education. And I was just really surprised at how little information people had and how little people knew, people that I respected, people educated, well-read. They just didn't have the facts. And as I talked to them, they jokingly said, you know, if you know so much, why don't you just run to Harrisburg and tell them yourself? And at first, you know, it was funny and it was a joke. And I started thinking about it, and I said, there's got to be a way I can make people more aware and also encourage them to be involved. So basically, as a parent, teacher, and runner, I put the three together, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to run the Harrisburg. And so I did.
And what kind of response did you get from folks along the way and when you arrived here?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you asked that. Well, I knew exactly how I felt leaving Philadelphia Thursday. I left from the Philadelphia School District, so I set out to find out how other people felt across the state. And I ran into I had people running with me almost the entire time. We started out with about, I guess, like 30 people in Philadelphia, mostly teachers. But the first person I started speaking to was an attorney, a Philadelphia attorney. And each person, I would just ask them a couple simple questions. Yeah, what do you think of your child's school? What do you think of their school district? And if they were to cut funding to your district or your school, how, you know, what do you think of that? And from the attorney in Philly, Leslie, to the dry cleaner, John, in Westchester, a waitress in Gap, PA, Amish farmer and her family in Lancaster, and even the campground owner, because we had a motorhome in Elizabethtown, not one person told me that they would be in favor of cutting or reducing school funding with their school. So, I mean, and it was across the board. So that's basically what I thought people, how I felt people when they was talking to them. And I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous on the air.
No, you're fine. And yet we've got a governor who proposed a billion-dollar cut to K-12 education, a 56% cut to higher education. Again, you know, I look at just that priority decision that he made, and, you know, I got to say, it looks to me that we're failing to invest in the future, just like we've failed to invest in our infrastructure. And what frightens me is that our education system down the road is going to be as tattered and broken and dysfunctional as our infrastructure is.
And I would agree. I would implore the elected officials, if I could have talked to them. When I arrived at the Capitol, it was Sunday night. They were nice enough to. They invited me on Monday. I was on the floor of the House, and they, you know, said a couple words. My representative, Maria Donatucci, said a couple words to the effect of what I did. But if I could speak to them personally, I just wanted to tell them that their actions on this particular issue are going to speak louder than any speech they make over the rest of their term.
I sure hope you're right on that.
And based on what the people I spoke to, I mean, not even one person thought it was a good idea. So I cannot believe that the elected officials really think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a saying I say to my students all the time. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. I think it's gotten to the point where and I don't mean to say they, the Republicans, just our elected officials, because I was trying not to make it. I never told anyone my party. I spoke to people of both parties, and I was trying to think of a way to just ask people to see what they would think. And I can't imagine. I mean, even the elected officials that I spoke to on the floor, when I posed the question, would you be in favor of reducing funds to your child's school? They didn't answer me, but you could see their face like, of course I wouldn't. I mean, what kind of question is that? And yet, that's what they're doing. So just because they can do it doesn't mean they should. But I feel like they, at this point, certain people know that they can do this, and they're going to do it.
Yep.
And it was real discouraging with me when I arrived. A lot of them just were basically telling me that it's a done deal. You know, you did this run. That's really cool. But it was a done deal before you even got here.
Here's my problem with it. And again, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, where during the 70s they tried busing because there were some failing schools, and they thought, well, gee, if we bus the kids around, we mix them all up, maybe that'll help. It turns out it didn't. It actually made things worse. I'm looking at, you know, the fact is they're saying 144 schools in this state are failing out of some 3,300. So instead of focusing on those 144, this is just the next idea. They've run out of ways of actually fixing the problems, and now this is just kind of let's throw something out there and hope it works. And if we privatize it, if we pawn it off on some private corporation, it's their problem now. It's no longer ours. We can then say, well, you know, it's private interest doing this.
Again, I agree with you 100%. When they refer, for instance, to charter schools, I say the implication is that there's this magic formula out there that's going to fix schools, and charter schools have it. And then in the next sentence, we're told that every charter school is going to be so different. And yet they have this formula in this magic formula that's going to work. And I look at it as, I've had small businesses at the shore. I had a bed and breakfast, and I've always been sort of an entrepreneur. I wrote my own children's book, and I think everything I read about small businesses is that 9 out of 10 small businesses fail within the first 2 years.
Right.
So why would we ever consider basically throwing our children in the Commonwealth into small businesses and then hoping that they're in the 1 out of 10 small business, which is what charter schools are, that's going to actually be the good one. So, yeah, let's double that and make 2 out of 10. So 2 out of 10 of them are going to work, and 9 of them are going to fail. And then they say, oh, well, why do small businesses fail? Well, we don't know why, because most of the owners, we can't reach them because they failed.
Right.
And we don't follow up on them. So we're ready to give our kids away. And then in 5 years, when they, you know, look over the charter schools, say, oh, well, that one didn't work. That one didn't work. Okay, this one's pretty good. That one didn't work. I mean, it's almost ridiculous. You cannot make money on schools, because that would imply if you're trying to make money, you're probably going to cut here and there, cut corners because you're trying to make money. Well, you're never going to use that profit and throw it right back into the business when it's children. So that it's mind-boggling that people, that, again, I know I'm going on and on here, but the implication is that there's this magic formula and they have it, and that we, with the regular public schools, we're intentionally not doing it right.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Do you think that they're trying to sell this as it's the magic pill? I think they're just going, we don't know what else to do. We surrender to the billionaire class who has said that they have a better model. And that's what this is. This is something pushed by the very, very wealthy in this country because they understand. They understand that we, the taxpayers, put an awful lot of money into educating our children, and that's the last, you know, profit motive business left because they've offshored most of the other jobs. That's a good local. It's not going to move.
That's a very interesting perspective. I didn't really see it that way, but that's very interesting.
I mean, it's part of the whole calculus. You look at the DeVos family, who's a billionaire family, who's spent, you know, buku amounts of money. In fact, our governor went to Washington D.C. to one of their conferences to be the keynote speaker, along with the guy from Wisconsin. So you know they've got to have some juice if our governor is heading down there, coming out of his rabbit hole to be seen down there.
Yes, I agree. I agree. That's very interesting. I didn't think of it that way.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Luigi Borda. His website, luigigetsaround.com, interesting site there. And being an educator, you know, one of the questions I keep asking people, okay, there's these 144 schools. They're struggling. They've got some problems. What do we do with these 144 schools who are, in my opinion, are probably in some of the highest poverty rate areas in the state, and struggle from a lot of economic problems to begin with and some broken family problems? What do we do to fix those 144 so that we can say to the other 3,100 that are doing okay, keep doing what you're doing, keep going, you're doing okay? How do we do that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'll answer it with the negative first. We certainly can't take money away from them at this point. Am I still in the air?
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. We certainly can't take money away from them. To think that even with, I often get told, you know, some of the school districts don't spend their money as wisely as they could. And even that, taking that as a given, pulling money away from children for next September, cutting teachers in those schools for next September, cutting services for those kids for next September, definitely is going to have a negative impact on those children. You can't possibly say that it doesn't. So to pull the money away cannot be the problem at this point. So you say, what's the answer? Okay, we obviously don't have the answer because, like you said, some people act like they do. But if there was an easy answer, then we wouldn't have this problem to begin with. The concern I have is all of a sudden, in a few short years, teaching has become this almost posh profession where we're highly paid now. We went from supposedly being low-paying jobs, but you did it because you wanted to, and to now we're getting paid too much, and we need to give back at all of a sudden, which blows me away because I think teaching is one of the few professions where people get into teaching because they really want to.
Yep.
And they stay in it because they want to. When I ask people what they do, the next question I ask is, do you really like what you're doing, and if you could do something else, would you? 9 times out of 10, they say they'd rather do something else, but they have to do what they're doing. The opposite is so with teachers. Most teachers could do something else, and they choose to teach.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you, Luigi. I don't know how you guys do it, taking the constant berating, the constant, you're overpaid, you're really demeaning your profession, and I don't know how you do it, but I'm glad you do.
Well, it's funny. I was with an upper engineer, an electrical union member yesterday, and we were talking about unions in general, and that they told me, and this was news to me, that they told me, you know, the other unions, we don't like the teachers union, and that's why we don't stick with them, because you're not really like us. And I said, well, that's interesting. I said, because for one thing, if they destroy our union, you know they're going to come after you guys.
You're next.
So that's one thing. The other thing is, the operating engineer, who's a very good friend, you know, I said, I didn't want to get into could you do our jobs. I just said, would you take my job tomorrow? And he said, no, put a curse word in, way.
Yeah, no way.
And I said, well, that's interesting, because you make twice as much as me, and you wouldn't do my job, right? But you know what? Quite frankly, I would do your job if I had to, and I certainly would do it for twice my salary if I had to. I wouldn't choose to, but I would. And yet there's no way you would do it, but in the next sentence, you say you don't like us. I said, that's part of the problem. For all of a sudden, teachers have to be embarrassed to say that they're teachers, because so many people are hammering them because they don't have the answer, but they're trying to pick on something. So they said, you know what? Let's pick on the teachers and see what happens.
Yeah, you won't hear me say anything about
that. Well, you're awesome. Thanks. This is the first time I listened to you, but I'm going to put you up on my Facebook right away, which, by the way, is Luigi Gets Around, and you can see my whole run to Harrisburg from Westchester to, I guess it was Gap, Lancaster, Elizabethtown, and then in Harrisburg.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And there's a link at our site at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Luigi's name. It'll take you right there. But here's the thing. I'm not going to berate anybody who spends probably more time with my children than I do. Because teachers spend, and this is factual, teachers spend more time with our kids than we do. So I want someone who's a professional. I want someone who's qualified, well-paid, and loves what they're doing. That simple. Luigi, great talking with you. Congratulations on the run. Great thing you did. I'd love to talk to you again sometime in the near future.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Next year I'm going to have something up, some other run set up. There's something about running around our capital with 100 teachers. So I look forward to calling in that day.
Beautiful. Thank you. Luigi Borda, the website luigigetsaround.com. I'll link at our site at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Luigi's name. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think of this? Right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
17th century playwright William Congreve must have been a seer, for he wrote that even in hell there is no fury like a woman scorned. Apparently, he foresaw the tempest now roaring out of the League of Women Voters. Long considered to be the church ladies of American politics, the group is best known for its sober voter education efforts. But pow! The ladies have suddenly shattered that stereotype by delivering a powerful political punch to a couple of U.S. senators, making clear to a startled Washington that they are not to be trifled with. LWV recently ran some hard-hitting TV ads taking Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown and Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill to task for trying to weaken enforcement of clean air laws. "I was shocked," cried McCaskill. "To me, they have always been about civic engagement and debates." Well, hello, Senator. You've just been civically engaged by a group of feisty women who realize that their polite and earnest letter-writing efforts to lawmakers like you were not working. With both parties kowtowing to the money of corporate polluters, senators were simply ignoring the letters. So the group toughened up. Senator Brown whined that LWV's ad was an ambush, as though the little ladies should stick to their inoffensive knitting. Pathetically, he tried to retaliate with an impetuous video slapping at the women's credibility, whimpering that they, quote, have gone to the gutter with their negative ads. Get a grip, Scott. You voted to gut EPA's Clean Air Authority, so it's hardly gutter politics for a group of mothers and grandmothers to point that out to voters. You've also taken campaign cash from the lobbyists with whom you voted, so it's your credibility that's in question. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking that senators are shocked when they're called to account by fed-up voters like the League of Women Voters.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
So, you know, the people over at the Tinky Tank, they came out with this lifesaver certificate. They put a light, little pack of lifesavers on this certificate, and they handed it out to legislators saying, you know, delaying legislative action on school choice does only one thing. It guarantees tens of thousands of Pennsylvania kids will go back to violent schools where the three R's that have become riots, robberies, and rapes. Get this. Robberies, riots, and rapes. That's what they're being taught. And then you see this other group, this Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, another right-wing group just like that. You know, schools. You know, kids are going to be trapped in violent and failing schools. Schools where kids are beaten and even raped by their classmates. Kind of seeing the theme here? What they're trying to do is they're trying to scare you. There's riots and robberies and rapes. Gee, you know, I got to be honest. I didn't know that if we defunded something, violence would stop. Maybe if we defunded our prisons, we'd have a safe society. I don't know. Maybe if we use Republican logic. Anyway, let's go to the phones. I got Mike on line one. How you doing tonight, Mike?
Oh, pretty good, Rick. I was listening to your guest there, and I kind of had a discussion with Mr. Durgan here on the local radio show a while back about this subject. And I said, Bob, the problem is not the teachers and what they make. The problem is that you got all these standards requiring these degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and they aren't cheap. So I said, what you need to do if you don't want to pay what that kind of education and that kind of training cost is to just get rid of it. So just have the legislature reduce teaching to anybody that, you know, graduated from high school.
Anybody with a GED.
GED, or maybe even use some illegals.
Yeah, of course, correspondence course.
Right, whatever, and pay minimum wage and send your kids there. Now, the problem is the parents tend to get involved when that happens, and the parents might want to vote to pay more for better teachers and better schools. And the problem that comes in is, well, people don't want to raise taxes, but then the parents kind of want to raise taxes, and it gets to be a real problem. But to comment on what your last guest said about businesses failing, he's right. And typically the reason, primary reason that a new business fails is undercapitalization.
Right.
Doesn't have enough money to go the stretch until it catches on. The problem here is that when these schools take over and subsequently fail, all of the students that were going to that school are not going to have something to return to because they will have defunded and demanded those schools. And schools and school systems are very much like super tankers at sea. They're very difficult to stop quickly, and they're very difficult to start quickly. And if a school fails and you need, you know, enough space for 5,000 extra students next year, you're not going to get it. There's no way to do it.
Yep. And again, I go back to the very simple point that I made earlier. Look, I don't think they have a clue of how to fix the problem. There are 144 schools, I'm told, that are failing out of the 3,300 in the state. Yet what they're telling us we need to do is to completely destroy public education as we know it and remake it in some private profit motive scheme.
Well, and another thing is, Rick, the schools aren't failing. Our society is failing. The schools are just a symptom, an indicator.
Good point.
The fact that those schools are in that condition is indicative of the fact that our society is failing.
That's an excellent point. And I would argue, and you know, you look at the some of the schools that I've seen that are struggling, they're in high poverty areas. So it's more of, in my opinion, it's more of a question of poverty, of societal problems than it is kids not being able to learn.
Right. It comes back to we've exported the jobs, so the parents of the children no longer have a secure economic base. I don't know, did you see 60 Minutes over the weekend?
No, I didn't.
They were looking at a school in Florida where 1,000 of the students there were technically homeless because of the economic downturn.
Wow.
They were families of 5 living in a hotel room and looking at the impact of hunger on these kids. And people better wake up, because what's happening is that society's crumbling around us. And it's crumbling because of the Wall Street banksters and the total lack of patriotism on the part of people chasing the filthy buck.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Mike.
All right, Rick, you have a good night.
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it. Great hearing from you again.
See you.
You know, he's spot on. I mean, the reality is the jobs have left. The reality is we've got a tax code that's skewed to make the wealthy even wealthier. And you look at the recent report that's come up, you know, out of the Journal of Commerce. They're saying, look, you know, the containers coming into the country have risen by almost 6%. Here's the thing that gets me. You look at the number of containers that are coming into this country, well over 47% of them come from China. 717,000 containers a year, from foreign made products, Chinese made products into our nation every year. You know the next closest? 717,000 from China. The next closest is 50,000 from Japan. Look how badly skewed our trade is. And now we got a Senate who claims they've announced a breakthrough. We have a breakthrough. You know, the long-delayed trade agreements with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama, we have a breakthrough. They're going to schedule a markup committee on Thursday so they can mark up these three pieces of dung. Max Baucus, somebody I could really, really do without, said, these free trade agreements, together with the trade adjustment assistance, will boost our economy by billions of dollars and create new jobs and opportunity here at home. He goes on to say, this proposal opens lucrative new markets to American ranchers, farmers, and small businesses, while ensuring U.S. workers have all the help they need to adapt and thrive in the 21st century global economy. One, we've always had a global economy, so cut that nonsense out. But I don't know that you're going to thrive on what the trade adjusted assistance program is going to help. Those jobs are going to be gone. And I find it interesting that he said, oh, new markets for our ranchers and farmers, first out of the box, because that's who these benefit. And like we were talking about yesterday, the low-wage workers. You go down the list, John Kerry said, we're going to open up new markets to American products and help American workers adjust to the increasingly competitive world. Kerry criticized Republicans, saying, this reflexively, it's against the basic bargain of the trade adjustment things. They're against that because they just hate unions. And those unions just complicated the whole movement of the trade deals. You look at McConnell, who said, well, the Democrats just want a poison pill. He said, I've never voted against a trade agreement in my life, but if they put that trade agreement, that trade assistance stuff in there, I'm voting against it. And the reality here is, look, all this talk, and I'm kind of guilty of this myself, Jake, talking about the trade adjustment assistance, which I think has to be there. And I think Lori Wallach from Public Citizen is absolutely right. The TAA is basically job burial insurance. Once those jobs go, here's a little insurance money for you. Sorry your job died. And what we really should be talking about is pushing more NAFTA-style trade agreements that are absolutely going to kill American jobs. Especially at a time when we got unemployment the way it is. And again, I don't like having Obama, Baucus, and the Chamber of Commerce in a big group hug. Not happy about it. Not happy at all.
I guess my question is, Rick, I mean, it should be, and a trade adjustment should be there. It's been traditionally in there. But what are they going to train for? And even if they do get good training, are those jobs going to be here? I guess that's my question.
They're going to trade for. They're going to train for jobs answering the phone at Goldman Sachs in Singapore.
Well, we joke about it, but I have serious reservations that the jobs are going to be there, which in theory they're going to be training for.
Here's the reality, though. You know, you look at this. You look at the 717,000 containers every year coming into this country from China. We have got a serious problem with the Chinese. And if you look at the reality, the Senate today unanimously approved, I guess yesterday, they unanimously approved a resolution that deplored China's use of force against Vietnamese and Philippine ships in the South China Seas. Because the Chinese have grown more assertive. You know, they're thinking, hey, you know, we're feeling our oats. And the Senate, they passed a resolution today. A non-binding resolution, but still, it's a resolution. We're going to go back to our constituents and say, look how tough we were on the Chinese. We passed a non-binding resolution. We showed those Chinese. Amazing stuff. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with John Paul Smith. He's one of the locked out workers at Honeywell in Metropolis, Illinois. A year anniversary today. We're right back after this.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it happen!
With a PSECU Home Equity Line of Credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing Life is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
I got a bad day. I'm putting it up. Been calling me to find love. I got a bad day. I'm putting it up. Been calling me to find love.
So today, the 1 year anniversary of the workers at Honeywell in Metropolis, Illinois, being locked out, kicked to the curb. And again, you know, this isn't one of those examples where they were being unreasonable. They said, here, we wanted to sit down and negotiate. The company said, you'll take what we offer you and you'll like it. They said, we're willing to work with the old contract. We're willing to work with you. No, there's the door. And they brought in scabs. They brought in replacements. Unqualified people. Now, understand what these folks do. This is a... uranium enrichment facility. They make hydrofluoric acid. They use hydrofluoric acid. Nasty stuff. You got to know what you're doing. And I got to be honest, if I lived in Metropolis, Illinois, I think I would be very concerned, especially with some of the safety stuff that's been going on. In fact, that OSHA has cited Honeywell 17 separate times for serious violations. $119,000 in fines. That's pathetic. Anyway, I've got John Paul Smith on the phone. He's one of the locked out workers, one of the communications people with the United Steelworkers Local 7-669. John Paul, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, thank you, and thanks for the tribute picture on your Facebook profile today.
Well, we're with you, brother. I mean, the reality is it's been a year. Workers should not have – this really, to me, highlights the fact that we have a broken, fractured, just a horrible problem with labor law in this country, that for a year you guys would be kicked out to the curb, and that company would still be operating with unskilled people, and you got a CEO running around with the president. Something wrong there.
Sure, and you look at the last year since the lockout. Now, just since the lockout, they've had NRC violations. They've had a guilty plea on an EPA case where they had to pay $12 million in fines, and now the 17 OSHA violations.
I mean, at some point, you know, and I guess this is trying to dig into the corporate mind, but at some point, isn't it worth just saying, okay, guys, let's work something out. We want to get you back to work so we don't have to keep paying all of these fines and all of these judgments?
Well, you would think so. If I was running a business, that's the way I would look at it. But, you know, when you're running around with the president and you have the mindset that you're above the law or above any government agency, maybe you don't think that way.
You know, as someone who I'm sure you live near the community, I can't imagine how the community in Metropolis, Illinois, is taking this. Because, you know, the last time I talked with somebody, there was something like 7 or 8 rail cars full of some pretty nasty stuff piled up outside the facility. And I'm going, you know, the Republicans love to talk about the post 9/11 world. To me, that's a pretty big danger.
It's a very big danger. And then you've seen recently at least the attempted block on the chemical security bill, which, you know, directly affects us with the hydrofluoric acid sitting right next to the highway.
Explain to people who don't know what hydrofluoric acid is.
Hydrofluoric acid is probably one of the most, you know, corrosive acids known to man. It's a calcium seeker. So if it comes in contact with your skin, especially in diluted form, you might not know right away because it seeks the calcium. So you actually get a chemical burn from the inside out. And approximately, I don't know, about the size of the palm of your hand, contact with the skin of anhydrous HF, which is what we use at the plant, is considered a fatal dose.
A fatal dose. I mean, as I understand it, basically just turns your bones to powder, and you basically just, you're done.
Right. And you know, we've been lucky enough to have a fatality at the plant, but we've had some close calls in the past with experienced workers. You know, I hate being locked out, but I wouldn't want to be in the plant with the replacement workers right now either.
Now, 17 separate serious violations. This isn't normal operating procedure with a skilled workforce, as far as I understand.
No, and then, you know, the Honeywell spokesman comes out with a statement in one sentence saying that there's no issue with current operations, and the next sentence saying that they plan to rapidly address the OSHA concerns. So I really don't understand how it can be both. And you look at the current citations, and virtually all of them have to do with current operations. So you know what? I do live fairly close to the plant, but if I lived downwind, I'd probably be a lot more nervous.
Yeah, I hear you. So let me ask you this, John Paul. It's been a year. Has there been any progress on ending this? Has there been any discussion on ending this whole thing?
Well, you know, we have a few things that have been agreed upon within the contract, but the fact of the matter is when we left the negotiating table last month, we laid out a proposal that we told Honeywell would settle the contract. And we thought we had a deal worked out. That was on a Wednesday evening. The Thursday morning, we went back to the table, and Honeywell said, no, the deal's off, back to square one again. And so basically that's where we're at. We told them, look, you know what it's going to take to settle the contract.
give us a call when you're ready for this to be over.
And where does this go from here if they say, we're just not going to do it? Where does this end up for you guys?
Well, hopefully it ends up, them giving us a fair agreement before they kill somebody or somebodies in that plant or in our community.
What kind of support are you getting from the folks in the community?
Community support's been great. We've got several donations of food, water throughout the last year on the picket line, as well as, continued support, people stopping and reassuring us that what we're fighting for is right.
I look at this a year. This has got to be hard on the family, got to be hard on family life and the whole, for the whole community.
It is. And, especially, in my family, for instance, we've had to make several adjustments to the way we live our life. But at the same time, I've also had the last year to spend a lot more time with my family. So I can't say it's all bad, but obviously we'd all rather be working.
So what can we do to help? I mean, is there any pressure that can come to bear? What's the next step?
We can continue to support our petition drive at experiencematters.usw.org and just continue to let the company know, let Honeywell know that what they're doing is not safe and they're putting a lot of people at great risk for unnecessary cause. We've been willing since the beginning of the lockout to continue to work while we negotiate for another contract.
Now, then the key here is that, and that I think is important to understand, that you guys were willing right from the beginning to say, look, we'll just keep working while we work this out, be like a partnership between the workers and the company, not wanting to disrupt operations. They're the ones who made the, you can get out.
Sure, and we would have worked with a contract extension, or we would have continued to work without a contract and negotiate. And we actually offered, we didn't want to just leave that plant. It's our community as well. We wouldn't have just left the plant, got up and walked out with all this stuff, these acids and this material, left to the scabs. We offered a 30-day notice before any strike action would have been taken. So they would have had a month notice before we went on strike, but that wasn't agreeable to them either.
So they just kicked you to the curb. And to me, again, it shows the fractured nature, the broken nature of our labor law, and the need for serious reform. But this is the 1 year anniversary, and I wanted to make sure we talked to you and said, hey, we support you. We're going to do whatever we can do to help, and let you know that there are folks out here thinking about you.
No, I appreciate it, and we're going to keep fighting the fight, and you guys keep doing what you do and making sure that the truth gets out.
John Paul Smith, I appreciate your time, brother. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Again, I look at this, and what's just amazing to me is, you look at the violations, 17 separate serious violations. $119,000 in fine, as he said, the EPA fine of, I think he said $12 million. At some point, doesn't it become just cost effective and just good business to say, let's end this and get the skilled people back to work? Just nuts.
Well, it points out the fact that those fines, especially $119,000, woefully inadequate. We need labor law reform in the worst way.
Absolutely. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think? We're right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse, because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. You know, every time I talk to John Paul Smith, and the situation out there, it just highlights the fact that we in this country, we don't respect workers. We are the pro-business. Evidently, we've decided we're going to be a business nation where business will decide and all of you lowly workers, you'll take what you get. And even when business screws us over, we'll still be beholden to them. And I look at the fact that the Department of Defense's Office of the Inspector General, they're claiming that Boeing has overcharged the Army for just basic spare parts. You know, whatever, you know, just small stuff. Overcharged them crazy amounts. Like for a, you know, just a cotter pin. You know, $71 for this kind of a cotter pin thing, just a metal pin that costs 4 cents to make. Charged $71. They charged over $644 for this small gear, smaller than a dime, that sells for $12.50 on the open market. They $645 almost. 5,100% increase. How do I get a gig like that? They sold another piece, another tiny part, about the size of a dime, $1,680. It was worth $771. 2,100% markup. They sold this metal, the thin metal pin, you know, kind of like a penny nail, that the Army already had tens of thousands of. Sold it to them for $71.01. It's worth four cents. A 1,700% markup. And then you look at the report, and according to the audit, Boeing, in addition to marking up the price 177,000%, they also charge a 34% surcharge fee for overhead, general, and administrative costs, as well as profit. But Boeing's sacrosanct. We can't possibly hold Boeing accountable, can we? But they're a private company, Rick. They're a private company. Yeah, who's really, really screwing over the taxpayer. And I look at Mitt Romney, who is right now the early front runner to carry the presidential nomination for the Republicans. He said on Monday that he wanted people with extensive private sector experience. Those are the people going to be in my cabinet. Those are the folks who are important. I want, you know, hedge fund managers and equity firm people. I want folks who are business savvy. He says, quote, in a cabinet, I would hope that people had worked in the private sector for at least half of their careers. at least half their careers. He said, I like the idea that people would come to the government knowing how the private sector works. Yeah, and how to manipulate government to screw them over and charge them 177,000%. I mean, that's the reason you get business people in the government. That's it, man. What happened to us? What happened to us as a nation where we're willing to even consider a guy like Romney who's telling you right from the start, man, I'm the business guy. I'm the guy who goes in, buys up a company, saddles it with a bunch of debt, spins the one part off to die, and let the taxpayer take care of that. Let the bankruptcy code take care of that. I'm going to keep the profitable stuff. You can't run government like that. But that's how we run business. And that's how we profit. That's how we become multimillionaires like Romney. I mean, it's really just plain nuts. And this is the guy that we're talking about making president. He's going to be president. You know, the fact that we're talking about Newt Gingrich as a president. Nuts. Here's a guy can't balance a checkbook, evidently, because half his staff quit because he's got no money in his account. You know, half his people took off. The Herman Cain train, we haven't heard much from them lately. You know, like Gingrich, had some staff defections, but I think Herman actually has maybe a buck in his checking account to pay his staff. But still, you know, at the end of this, it's just insane. Wow. And this thing with China just has me nuts. The fact that we have a Senate that we passed a non-binding resolution. Ha-ha! You shot up that Vietnamese ship and the Philippine ship, you know, they use force against those. You got your army war machine. You got your machine out there. We're going to pass a resolution. That's going to stop the Chinese. That's going to stop them from dumping in our ports. That's going to stop them from taking over our manufacturing. Oh yeah, that non-binding resolution. That's going to send a message. Oh, yeah.
Congress didn't see anything wrong with allowing some of our major defense contractors to share technology with China, technology that could be used by the military and is. I mean, China's military, they're building up at a very rapid pace. They're investing large amounts of money. And the technology that we give them, I still think that it's absolutely insanity that we think that for 1 minute the Chinese wouldn't hesitate to adapt that for military use. They absolutely will.
But we passed a resolution. It's non-binding. Boy, I'm so glad that we have the people in Congress passing those resolutions while they're eating our lunch. I mean, I'm just stunned. 717,000 containers of product coming dumped into this country. Furniture and auto parts and you name it. And auto parts was the biggest jump. Had a 29% increase. Didn't we used to make auto parts in this country at one point? Oh, that's right. We let Delphi break their union and move a good number of their jobs overseas. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Delphi used to be a big employer in Michigan. Used to.
You know, at the end of this, it comes down to these trade agreements. And we've now got a Senate who's hell-bent. And we've got a president who's hell-bent. And I look at this and I go, hey, whoa. What happened to campaign Obama? What happened to campaign Obama going, hey, we're not going to, you know, we're...
You can trust me when I say that whenever trade deals we negotiate come to my desk, they are going to be good for American workers, that they'll have powerful labor and environmental protections, and that we will enforce those protections.
You
can trust me.
Yeah, you can trust me. I'm going to do it. Not so much. Now, look, we're just negotiating through this right now, but at the end of the day, do you really think the working people of this country are going to benefit from those three trade agreements? Especially with Colombia? I think we're getting all the cocaine and coffee we need. Thank you very much. But they say it's going to open up, it's going to open up a very profitable market. Sorry, I'm not seeing it. Now the South Koreans, they're seeing an opportunity to sell their more cars. And I love the justification for this. the justification for passing these agreements is that we've already given them access to our markets. They're already dumping into our markets and beating the living daylights out of us. So, you know, we're going to open up part of their market. I mean, that's the rationale. I tell you how screwed up we are as a nation that we just go, yeah, come on, bring her. Come on, bring it in, bring it in. Yeah, never mind. Don't worry about those workers. Who cares about them? We'll just dangle a little shiny thing in front of their face. Like, the story, NPR has a weekly quiz show, evidently, called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You want some dangly stuff? Since evidently we don't want to talk about anything substantive. President Bill Clinton was on. Woohoo! He was on Saturday's TV program. Woo! He was on their program. He was asked about the weekend TV program. It was called My Little Pony. Friendship is magic. And do you know our president, who evidently knows everything? Because the host said, you're a former president, you're a Rhodes Scholar, and you're famously well-informed. He said, what could we be sure that an accomplished person like you would know nothing about? And he said, My Little Pony. It turns out Clinton knew all about My Little Pony. In fact, was able to, in the multiple choice quiz, correctly identify the pony's worst enemy and the special talented pony named Rarity. So, there you go. Your shiny thing for the day. Doesn't that make you happy? Because evidently that's what our news media focuses on. I had to dig to find the number on the containers coming. I had to dig to find that. Our mainstream media didn't cover that. I had to dig to find a lot of the job numbers and a lot of the fact that we're losing hundreds of thousands of jobs to outsourcing. I had to dig to find the Goldman Sachs thing. 1,000 jobs they're moving to Singapore. I had to dig for that stuff. But you know what? Bill Clinton and My Little Pony, front and center. It was right there for me. I just had to click right on it. It was right there, right in my grasp. Isn't that beautiful? But, we have a media structure in this country that is second to none when it comes to covering the dumbest stuff you can think of. Because Bristol Palin's got a new book coming out. Mm-hmm. Drunk and Stupid should have been the title of it, but it was something else. The media focused on, and I love this one too. Remember Carol Brady? Anybody remember Carol, Florence Henderson? Carol Brady, remember her? She played the mother there. Turns out she was cheating on her husband with the former mayor of New York City. And she got crabs. That made news. That was actual news here in the United States. Why? I have no idea. I thought Carol Brady was dead. Yet here I got to read a story about her getting crabs some 30 years ago. That's news.
And that would have been?
Well, she's got a new book.
Who was the mayor?
Lindsay, I think his name
Lindsay?
Was.
Lindsay? Okay, yeah, all right.
He's now long dead, but this was back in the 60s. I had a couple of drinks. Again, drunk and stupid. Had a couple of drinks. So I said, well, what the heck? I'm lonely. What the heck? So I did it. Woke up in the morning with little black things crawling all over me. I'm going, that's entertainment. That's news. That's front page stuff. You know what would have been front page stuff even more? Had she admitted to nailing the curly-headed guy who keeps running around saying, yeah, I got her. Greg Brady, forget what his name is, but again, that's news. Or is it? The fact that we're losing the middle class in this country, that should be news. The fact that it's harder and harder to reach the middle class from starting out in poverty, that should be news. The fact that wages have been stagnant for 30 years, that should be news. The fact that we got some 50 to 60 million people uninsured, that should be news. The fact that people are dying because they make $12 too much and they can't get Medicaid, that should be news. Not Carol Brady getting crabs. We're right back after this.
RFK in the USA.
deeply blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. In stark contrast to Wisconsin Democrats, New Jersey's Democratic State Senate President Steve Sweeney, several Democratic state senators, and about a third of Democrats in the state House led a betrayal of working families to help Republicans gut public worker collective bargaining in New Jersey. Barbara Kasichian is president of the New Jersey Education Association. She told WBAI's Building Bridges program that the Democrats helped impose staggering new costs on public workers while violating collective bargaining rights and defeating a millionaire's tax that would have spread the sacrifice.
This bill increases worker contributions to the pension plan by 40% while eliminating cost of living adjustments for retirees for 30 years. And then in addition to it, it eliminates collective bargaining over health care and imposes enormous increases in the cost of health care, between 300 and 500% increases for health care. The vast majority of the Democrats are opposing this, but we have this group of Christiecrats who are doing this, and they are unraveling collective bargaining. It's the only state in the country where Democrats are in the lead in trying to unravel public worker collective bargaining. It's shameful.
35,000 Ford workers want their grievances over reinstatement of merit pay and 401k matches to be settled before they vote on any new contract later this year. The UAW is working with Ford on the grievance signed by the workers. Non-union salaried workers got their merit pay reinstated along with 401k matches in 2010, but hourly workers didn't. The workers say that violates the existing contract. The National Labor Relations Board is holding hearings July 18th and 19th in Washington, D.C. on proposed new rules that would speed up union representation elections. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka calls the proposed rules changes a common-sense approach to clean up an outdated system. Unions have long wanted faster NLRB elections because anti-union businesses often use delaying tactics and intimidation campaigns to scare workers out of supporting unions. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says with the unprecedented assaults this year on workers' rights in states across the country, the NLRB is taking a positive step for workers who want to exercise their fundamental rights to decide for themselves whether to form a union. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The right to bargain is the right that's fundamentally about power to the people. That's where it should be. It's called justice. It's called democracy. So hear this, Scott Walker, because your time is limited. Let us tell you what your big problem really is. It ain't your nagging, finger wagging, budget deficit. The problem lies with your moral deficit.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Well, tomorrow, just I guess in a little under an hour, the theft of workers' rights goes into place. The Supreme Court there in Wisconsin, I guess after the judge decided to take his hands off the other judge's neck. Amazing there. But this law is going to go into effect, and you're basically stealing the right of collective bargaining away from a large number of workers. And I got to be honest, I loved what Walker said. There was an article in one of the newspapers out there. He said, yeah, I should have prepared the public earlier for the changes that were coming. You mean by telling them when you were running, having an actual platform that you were going to go keep? Maybe that? And he was talking about this whole theft thing, and he's going, well, you know, they, meaning the unions and all the people that came out and people like me who came to Madison, defined it as a rights issue. He says, it's not a rights issue, this whole union thing, not collective bargaining, not a rights issue. It's an expensive entitlement. I always thought it was a right. Here, I always thought there was something in that little piece of paper they like to talk about the right of assembly and, you know, all of that. Maybe I'm wrong. To find out what's going on there and where we're going to be moving from here is Adrian Padgett. She's a grad student in the sociology department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, also the co-president of the TAA out there, one of the folks who I'm sure was involved back in February when we were there. Adrian, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
You know, I remember being in the Capitol the night they rammed through their bill.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was an energy there with people saying, we're going to fight back. We're going to make sure that that they pay for this. And I think that energy is still going today, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. I'm sure, as you've seen, despite the fact that Pastor Walker has tried to downplay the resurgence of the labor movement, most certainly here in Wisconsin, but I think across the U.S. and elsewhere in the world, there's a tremendous amount of energy, and the labor movement is most certainly not dead, though I believe he wishes it were. I think that he is unwittingly perhaps responsible for, breathing life into something that we as proud union members have always believed in and thought about as precious. But I think that it's now gotten a lot of attention from other folks who might not have known what unions were about or had the good fortune of being in a union themselves.
Right. You know, tell me about what's this, in, I guess, less than 55 minutes from now at midnight it takes effect. What is this going to do to the public sector workers, to the teachers, to folks like you in less than an hour? What's going to happen to folks like you?
Well, so many things, really. But, some of the major things are that our collective bargaining rights are only going to be, will be limited to one issue, that of wages, and the wages will be capped. So even though we will be technically allowed to bargain over wages, we cannot bargain for a wage that would go beyond the rate of inflation. We will also be required to, pay in or contribute more to our health plans and pension plans, which unions across the state had, negotiated separately. And I think one of the major issues is the removal of the fair share or agency agreement, wherein individuals who would have been covered by a collective bargaining agreement as won by a union will not have to pay in will not have to pay any sort of dues, but still enjoy the wins a union obtains for them. And then the final blow is the requirement to recertify each and every year with an election. And I believe that's going to be particularly onerous on unions here in the state, but I think we're up for it.
Well, I sure hope so. And you look at the fact, and the Republican mantra seems to be, we want a whole bunch of free riders. We want a bunch of people mooching off of others, which is why they included that free rider portion in there. But here's what bothers me. When you look at this attack on workers' rights, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country, and they try and neuter you by saying, well, you can only negotiate for wages. So you get a wage increase, they just jack up your health care premiums.
That's right.
I mean, it's almost comical that they're saying, well, this is somehow fair. That's what gets me.
Yeah, it's absurd. And actually, I think that it would have been completely unfathomable for him to completely disregard collective bargaining. So though we all recognize it as seeing it as a very effective removal of all essential collective bargaining rights. Governor Walker has engineered this sort of project in order to, so he can at least make the very technical claim that no collective bargaining rights still exist in the state of Wisconsin. It's just that they're limited to this very narrow spectrum. And as you point out, the wins that we are even able to gain will be removed due to the fact that there have been substantial cuts in so many other areas and then increases in taxation and other places that we're going to have to contribute in order to, cover ourselves and provide for ourselves.
So let me ask you this, Adrian. As we're moving down the road, there are a lot of recall petitions out there. I understand 6 Republicans are up for recall. Pretty good chances of getting at least 3 of them, so you can stop any future moves. But 2012 down the road, is there any chance of taking back control and then maybe undoing some of this negative stuff? Is there a possibility of going backwards?
Absolutely. I mean, backwards, which is ironic since our state motto is moving forward, and Governor Walker has actually sent us backwards, 60 years backwards, 80 years backwards. I think that there's plenty of momentum and anger that will propel the recall movement forward beyond the July primaries and the August elections. That will take place for the recall of the 6 Republican senators and the 3 Democratic senators that are also up for recall, and should provide plenty of momentum going into the gubernatorial recall. And I think that Governor Walker actually underestimates how many people are quite dissatisfied with what he has done. I think you hit the nail on the head with the statements he made in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel today about not preparing the public for what his malintentions were in regards to working people. And I think that he had absolutely no idea what he was unleashing and what he was doing, reinvigorating working people and showing them that if they unite together, the power that they can have to affect change and change that actually benefits them.
We went out in February for the height of all the activity. And
yeah.
I got to be honest, we went out for a couple of reasons. One, it was a historic thing. I mean, to get 100, 150,000 people in the Capitol and in the surrounding area coming out and protesting is just an amazing thing in this country. But also to bring back the message that, this is about people coming together and being part of their government. And we kept hearing this is what democracy looks like, just like you heard in the clip. And I often talk about in the Capitol, the TAA and some of the folks who were kind of coordinating things in there. They set up child care. They set up a health care station. They set up places to get fed. It was really an amazing moment of community. And that, I think, is the big mistake that Walker made. He has brought the community together where they've spent 30 years dividing us.
Absolutely. I think that I was just as shocked as any. I think that we all were, and particularly this is the biggest thing I've ever been a part of in my life. As I've heard in your previous radio programs, we all have, I think, a working knowledge of the labor movement, the history of the labor movement, of the struggles that our brothers and sisters have endured before us. But to see it firsthand was really special. And I think that, in speaking with I spent a number of nights at the Capitol, and we were there, as were many other groups, undergraduates, faculty, other unionists, both from the private sector, the public sector, concerned community members, high school students, parents, like everyone was there. And what became clear to me in talking to, this whole clash of people was that they realized that this was yet another way that they could have political voice. And I think that that's actually been lost on many and perhaps lost on quite a few from my generation and younger. It's gotten to a point where we believed that the only way we could make our voices heard was at the ballot box. And while that is true, an important tactic, an important way to go, there are also these collective action, direct action yep. moves where we can also influence our legislators, influence the public and push for the things that we want to push for. I think that it's lost on people, or people tend to forget that, the wins that were made during the New Deal era weren't necessarily because the Dems really wanted to do them. It was the fact that there were hundreds of thousands, millions of people out of work protesting, fighting, and fighting together that made the real difference.
And demanding.
And put the pressure. Yeah.
And the reality is, you know, this is the living embodiment of the campaign slogan that Obama ran on in 2008. Yes, we can. And that was, yes, we can in action.
Yes. Absolutely.
You know, and the last thing, and I think Wisconsin's a little unique in this country in that it does have labor education in the schools. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought in talking to a lot of people that the spark that got people out in the street was when Walker said, we're going to call in the National Guard. And that little bit of labor education that's in the schools, you know, harken people back to the Latimer massacre, Ludlow massacre, where the National Guard was called out to shoot workers. There's part of me that thinks that was... And the folks that I talked to, that was the spark.
I think that it definitely solidified our decision to remain and stay because we understood that staying together was actually, we would be safer and stronger to stay together. I think that there were so many different situations and so many different decisions that were being made of people willing to sacrifice themselves and you know, perhaps their own individual job security to come out and be a part of what we accomplished for those weeks and the months following of teachers choosing to have stick outs and you know, under high school students choosing to march with their teachers after class for miles to the Capitol of firefighters and police officers who were, you know, originally exempt, willing to stand beside their public sector brothers and sisters and say, no, this is absolutely wrong. We cannot abide by this. This is immoral and unjust, and it's an attack on working people and therefore an attack on the state and what makes Wisconsin great.
Yeah, I think Walker has done what the labor movement was not capable of doing. It has united them.
Absolutely.
Adrian Pagic, I appreciate your time. Grad student at the sociology department there at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and also the co-president of the TAA out there. I appreciate your time. Keep up the fight, and we'd love to have you back again as these recalls move forward and the recall of Governor Walker begins.
Hear, hear. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
3,000 people screaming out, where's our government? More suits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Walk billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have took into account that we never give up. We'll be here one day longer. One day longer. The people's voice is stronger. The people's voice is stronger. We have fought for our money, we will talk with respect. Keep fighting for these rights for generations. One day longer.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
17th century playwright William Congreve must have been a seer, for he wrote that even in hell there is no fury like a woman scorned. Apparently, he foresaw the tempest now roaring out of the League of Women Voters. Long considered to be the church ladies of American politics, the group is best known for its sober voter education efforts. But pow! The ladies have suddenly shattered that stereotype by delivering a powerful political punch to a couple of U.S. senators, making clear to a startled Washington that they are not to be trifled with. LWV recently ran some hard-hitting TV ads taking Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown and Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill to task for trying to weaken enforcement of clean air laws. I was shocked, cried McCaskill. To me, they have always been about civic engagement and debates. Well, hello, Senator. You've just been civically engaged by a group of feisty women who realized that their polite and earnest letter-writing efforts to lawmakers like you were not working. With both parties kowtowing to the money of corporate polluters, senators were simply ignoring the letters. So the group toughened up. Senator Brown whined that LWV's ad was an ambush, as though the little ladies should stick to their inoffensive knitting. Pathetically, he tried to retaliate with an impetuous video slapping at the women's credibility, whimpering that they, quote, have gone to the gutter with their negative ads. Get a grip, Scott. You voted to gut EPA's Clean Air Authority, so it's hardly gutter politics for a group of mothers and grandmothers to point that out to voters. You've also taken campaign cash from the lobbyists with whom you voted, so it's your credibility that's in question. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking that senators are shocked when they're called to account by fed-up voters like the League of Women Voters.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Show 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Reuters is reporting that up to one in six European banks may be set to fail in an EU-wide financial health check, because they have actually got stress tests. According to one Eurozone source close to the stress testing, they got one in six. They're saying some 10 to 15 of the 91 banks that are being scrutinized, could fail. Casualties across Germany, Greece, Portugal, and Spain. And I keep going, do we have stress tests here? How much money have we pumped into our banks? How much have we propped them up? You look at Goldman Sachs, how much money did we give them? And what they do? They said, here, we're going to take 1,000 jobs out of the country. How very nice. Just craziness, folks. Anyway, the White House announced today that they're seeking to raise $600 billion in revenue, according to Business Insider, through new taxes and the elimination of corporate subsidies as part of their idea on how to lower the deficit and to raise the debt ceiling. All of this is going to be this whole kind of bargaining back and forth. The one line that I think the Democrats have to draw the line in the sand is no Medicare, no Medicaid cuts. Sorry, not going to happen. I'm afraid that they're going to cave, and we're, 36 odd days out, 35 odd days out before the August 2nd deadline. Now, there are some things that the president has put out, and the Associated Press has said, there's some things that they want to do. They want to end the subsidies for oil and gas companies, which the Republicans are hell-bent against. Because after all, they're saying, if you cut those subsidies, you're going to raise the price of gas. Oh, if you cut those subsidies, they're going to lay people off. If you cut those subsidies, Armageddon, the end of the world. And I'm sorry, does a company as profitable as ExxonMobil need money from us? No. I don't think so. Another idea, according to the AP, that the White House has come up with is a tax on private equity or hedge fund managers. You tax those billions that they're making at higher income rates instead of the 15% capital gains. So the guy who made the smart bet, we're going to bail out the auto companies, or made the smart bet that we're going to bail out the financial institutions, put a whole bunch of money on the banks, and made $4 billion in a year, paid 15% capital gains, maybe we jack that up a little bit. Maybe just a little bit. And while we're in Pittsburgh, because we're going July 17th through the 21st, we're going to be out there covering the AFL-CIO's community service events. I'm going to do some speaking while I'm out there. The Progressive Caucus is actually going to be rolling through Pittsburgh during that time frame. So I'm hoping to be able to get into some FaceTime with some of the folks in the Progressive Caucus. I guess Conyers is going to be there, maybe a couple other folks, in pushing this progressive budget, which is talking about doing some of these things, having a millionaire's tax like Schakowsky's bill that says, maybe we raise that top marginal rate from 35 up to, 45, and then the more you make, the bigger your shoulders, the more water you can carry. Maybe start talking about that. Maybe start talking about, hey, let's pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Let's give workers the opportunity to organize and maybe demand some of the wealth that they're creating. Because I don't know if you've been looking. Corporate profits are doing quite well, thank you very much. The CEO suites are as plush as ever. The caviar is right there for their consumption. That seems to be a smart thing to do. So we're going to bring you some of that from there, so that'll be good as well. But back to this thing with the AP, what they want to do also, the president says, you know what, we need to start limiting the itemized deductions for these rich people. And, you know, you go back to the alternative minimum tax, which, again, broken. We talked about that in the past. There are people in this country who don't even pay that. And this is going to kind of do some of that so that they can't deduct all their income away as well. They're going to change the depreciation formula for corporate jets. Did you know that they could do that? Every time they fly wherever they want to go, they could write it off. Isn't that nice for them? Do you get to write your car when you go back and forth to work? No, you don't. See, you're not a billionaire. They also want to repeal the tax benefit for the inventory accounting practices used by a number of manufacturers. This idea of last in, first out, so it isn't being counted. You know, it's just being used right through. They want to change some of that. I don't know about that so much, but the other stuff, all in favor of, and I could go even further. There's a number of things we should absolutely be doing that we're not. And I say you tax the billionaire class, like we talked about last night. There are 103,000 people on this planet that control just investable wealth, not their living standards, not the money that they've gotten, you know, in furs and in diamonds and in mansions and Bentleys, not that, just the money that they got rolling around in their piggy banks. $15 trillion. So what we've got, and 40% of those people right here in the U.S. So I say, you know what, the country's been pretty good to you. Buck up, bucko. Shoulders big, strong. Start paying a little bit, help out a little bit, contribute a little bit. Simple stuff.
You talked about the hedge fund managers, Jim Cramer, who's, you know, famous. He has his own show. And he was on today. He was on MSNBC. And he was interviewed, and he said, you know, he said those hedge fund managers are laughing. He said they're laughing about how little they pay. He said we should absolutely jack that up. And he said anybody that makes over $400,000, we need to try, and he said, I'm asking that you tax me more. But he said at minimum, $400,000 and up, they need to pay their fair share.
Well, duh. And I'm also in favor of a transfer tax. Every stock trade that's done, you take a very small percentage, and you tax it on it. You know, these supercomputers that are pumping out millions and millions of trades every minute, a very small transfer tax would be helpful. And you know, maybe, just maybe, and this is just a thought, and look, I'm not an economist, but maybe some of our economist friends might have an idea for me. But I think if we put a transfer tax on it, we might actually have people investing in companies for the long haul. You know, instead of, you know, how much money can I make today by gambling on Wall Street? Maybe you'll start investing in companies instead of just how much can I make today? And maybe we cut down on some of this, cut down just a little bit. On the mass speculation that's going on. You make it a little bit more expensive to gamble. I mean, it's like, you know, I gotta be honest, I look at Wall Street like any mob run casino. Because that's what it is. The house is always gonna win. The poor little schlub who's going in, who doesn't have all the inside information, you're screwed in this. You're not gonna win at this game. They'll throw you a bone every once in a while. It's like at the airport, the guy playing three card Monty. Eventually he's gonna let you win every once in a while. Pique your interest, but when the big money's down, you lose. Wall Street is no different. So I say, you know, you might as well do like the mob does. Put a little VIG on, get your little taste, a little VIG. You pay your little bit for every hand. Last time I remember, it was like 2%. So, you know, but here's the thing. You play that card game long enough, eventually the house gets all the money because you pay 2% of every pot to the house. Eventually, you know where the money goes. And I say you do the same thing with Wall Street. You slow down these supercomputers that are making millions of trades every day, and you benefit from it a little bit. The wealthy in this country have done very, very well. That's why I'm really looking forward to that progressive caucus coming through with the people's budget. We've talked to a couple people. I think Raul Grijalva from Arizona we had on the program talking about this. But, you know, moving forward, we got to talk about an alternative because the Republicans are only putting out the slash and burn, the pain and suffering for you, not for them. I think Robert Borisov, from the guy from the Campaign for America's Future, has a good idea. For every dollar that we cut, every dollar we cut to education, every dollar we cut to health care, every dollar we cut for social programs, safety net programs, food stamps, whatever, every dollar that's cut, We do like the Republicans say, got to raise it by, you got to pay for it by raising taxes on the wealthy by $1. Have a one-for-one proposition. If this is shared sacrifice, it's shared sacrifice, baby. Because every time they want to do something, oh, we'll help those people in Joplin, Missouri. Remember Cantor saying this? Yeah, we'll help those people, but we've got to offset it with cuts from somewhere else. That's what they think of this country. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to our friends at Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. We're right back after this.
This is why we fight, why we violate. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make everything happen!
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
To the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the nation, Ken Bizinet from Talk Radio News Service. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be with you this evening.
So what's going on in the big world? I see Obama's calling for a news conference.
Yeah, it's a move for the bully pulpit, I think. Obviously, his opening statement will most likely be connected to the debt relief debt limit negotiations going on with the Republicans. They're contentious, but I think he's holding most of the cards. This is not like a government shutdown. These bills have to be paid.
Right.
So somebody's going to have to come around on this. But at the same time, I don't think he likes his poll numbers right now.
No, I don't think so either. But at some point, what I'm waiting to see is the surrender flag, which is giving in on Medicare and Medicaid. If the Democrats do that, I think it's a dagger.
Well, I'll tell you, did you catch Bernie Sanders yesterday?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I mean, Comrade Bernie nailed it, I thought. It's good to have him in the Senate. I think he's a counterweight to, what we get from some of the hardcore right guys.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that he doesn't decide to go on Twitter mailing pictures of his wiener around.
Yeah, I don't think that's his thing. I think that he is a very decent guy. And, I don't think we're going to have that problem. He's an intellectual. This is a guy, as you know, who loads up buses of old people
yep.
and drives them across the Canadian border so they can get cheap medication. Yeah, he's my kind of guy. You know, in the healthcare debate, real quickly, the guy actually was able to get a couple of clinics. They now have 8 of these clinics around Vermont where the most you pay as a copayment is $7, and it's not emergency room care. It's primary care. Essentially, there is universal health care in Vermont. It's a little-known secret, but it is the God's honest truth. It is, you know, and that's his doing. He's a smart guy. He really cares about people.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you, he really kicked the president in the pants yesterday ahead of it and said, look, don't do this again.
Yeah, don't surrender. Don't do what Democrats have been known to do. Don't do what the Cheneys of the world have claimed Democrats only do, and that is surrender, capitulate, whatever. But I'm waiting for it.
Yeah, no, you know what? We've seen enough surrender. Think about that debate a couple of weeks ago. GOP presidential hopeful Tim Pawlenty, he was like set up to take out Mitt Romney on that Obama-nami.
Yep.
Obama-ami healthcare thing. And, you know, he showed up at the plate with a wiffle ball bat. And,
yeah,
you know,
chickened out.
I'll tell you what, he tried to make up for it today in New York City. He spoke in front of the Council of Foreign Relations, and it was a neocon speech. He was going for the right-wing pro-Israel vote, and he tried to take Obama down today.
Yeah, but how much of that do you think is, the Republicans, I mean, the seven dwarfs had to come together and say, hey, let's not beat each other up too much and give Obama ammunition. Let's all go after him.
Hey, you know what? I totally think that that's what happened. But look what happened to Pawlenty. He still looked like milquetoast.
Yeah, he did.
You can't whack a guy on paper and the next night when he's standing right on the side of you, refuse to make eye contact with him and not explain yourself.
Yeah.
We're talking about New Hampshire. Those are real people up there. You know, they paid attention to it. They didn't pay attention to it live because the Bruins were in the Stanley Cup. But I guarantee you, there were more DVRs operating in that state that night than anywhere else in the country on a per capita basis, you know?
Yeah, well, how many of them do you think were paying attention to Michelle Bachmann yesterday?
Well, that was just it. I mean, everybody expected her to, kind of fall on her face. And the next thing you know,
she did.
You find out she's got this A-team of political consultants, Ed Rollins, you know, one of the smartest, most sophisticated, you know, old school Republicans, and he pulls this Harry Higgins act, you know, and it's right out of My Fair Lady. She's speaking nothing but, you know, simple declarative sentences, right on messaging. I mean, in my opinion, you know, the woman won the night.
Yeah, but, you know, she announced her presidency again, her, you know, her candidacy for presidency again for the second time, and she goes and screws that up a couple of times. This morning on Stephanopoulos, yesterday with the whole, I've got the John Wayne Gacy spirit, you know, it's just kind of
nuts. Yeah. Well, you know, that was, that's the thing. That actually, I think, kind of plays into exactly what I'm talking about with, Rollins putting words in her mouth and doing a good job. When she was on script, I thought she gave a great speech for what she did. And then, as soon as she goes freestyle, she gets her John Wayne's confused in Waterloo. You know, and obviously your listeners, you know, probably know what we're talking about, but, you know, she talked about John Wayne coming from Waterloo when, in fact, it was John Wayne Gacy, the mass murderer. Yeah, that's kind of a big difference, you know.
The
other thing she doesn't understand, and you know this, she's in a different realm now. There are guys like me who are going to parse every single bit of, you know, every syllable that comes out of her mouth now.
Yep.
This is a big show.
You can't be Tea Party crazy now.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing, you know. And, you know, I've been a White House correspondent for 17 years. I can tell you that, the big guy at Palace 1600, she's the one he wants.
Oh,
obviously.
Absolutely.
Because it becomes, as you know, this is not, we're not breaking any new ground here. These elections are a fight for the middle. And you and I both know that the middle's pretty sensible and they're going to look at, you know, ad after ad of the kind of off the wall things that she's talked about for the last 10 years and just go, yeah, she's very articulate, you know, when she's working from a script, but when she's not, she thinks the American Revolution was begun in New Hampshire and not conquered in Lexington. And, you know, and that's a problem.
It is a problem. Kevin, the last thing we've got here, the Greek financial crisis, to kind of get us back to the topic. What's going on over in Greece right now? I've seen some violence. I've seen more austerity. Some of that could be coming to our shores, no?
20,000 people today taken to the streets, and then all of a sudden, a handful of them start lobbing Molotov cocktails at 4,000 police officers circling the parliament. I mean, it really, it got violent, and then fortunately, they're smart people, and it got under control after the authorities started firing tear gas back. But I'll tell you, they've got this $40 billion package that they're voting on tomorrow, and everybody's getting a tax increase from the bottom up, the littlest guy, the poor people are going to have to pay more taxes, all the way up to the top, and then the job cuts are just brutal, and they've got to sell everything. They built all of those Olympic, stadia and arena, all those facilities, they're selling all of that. They've got to sell the power companies. They've got to sell every utility. It's really, really something. And quite frankly, part of it is because, they've got this sort of, loan shark La Cosa Nostra kind of deal that was put in front of them when the IMF and the EU, gave them that, mega loan a few months ago. They came up with these crazy, horrible terms, and next week, the Greeks have to come up with a $17 billion interest payment, not a nickel on principal.
Got them right where they want them, right
under their thumb. Oh, man, and as we all know, if it doesn't work out, if they default, it's a domino. It'll literally go right across Europe, and it will jump. It will jump, just like when our crisis in 2008 broke. It started here, but it jumped, and it just kept going around the globe. I literally remember staying up for long stretches of time just watching the financial news television networks, because, they just did 24/7 during that whole thing, and it was breathtaking. We can't take another hit like that.
Absolutely not. It'll be interesting to see how this works itself out, because who knows? Who knows where we may be in a year or two? Ken Bezanetta, I appreciate the time. Look forward to talking to you again. Thanks so much.
Hey, it was my pleasure. We'll talk tomorrow.
All righty, Ken Bezanetta, Talk Radio News Service. And now to find out what's going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight,
Jim? Yeah, thanks, Rick. In the Patriot News, big news today. The Senate has passed the $27.15 billion budget, and it's going to send it to the State House for consideration. The Senate passed it by 30-20, right along party lines, to approve the $27.15 billion budget for the year 2011-2012, calls for no tax increases, and softens many of the cuts that Governor Tom Corbett included in his budget proposal, particularly in the area of education and hospitals. It now goes to the State House for consideration. Senate Majority Leader Dominic Pileggi, a Republican from Delaware County, called it fiscally responsible, sustainable budget. He said, admittedly, it contains some unpopular cuts, but it resets state government spending to a level it can afford. However, the Senate Appropriations Committee Chairman Vince Hughes, one of our guests from time to time on this show, Democrat from Philadelphia, called it a trick on Pennsylvania because it includes deeper cuts than are necessary given the anticipated $700 million revenue surplus. The fact is there are dollars to be spent and invested in issues people care about very much. And I agree wholeheartedly with Vince Hughes. This is a very controversial budget. I think the Republicans could be playing with fire, especially their budget cuts, when it comes to affecting programs that affect the truly needy, and also educational cuts. I think the Republicans could very well at the ballot box pay for some of these draconian cuts, but only time will tell. Pakola's bill mandating Harrisburg's Act 47 plan, it passed the Senate. Again, on a party line vote, the state Senate voted 29 to 21, to pass Senator Jeff Pakola's bill that, if enacted, would effectively turn Harrisburg Act 47 plan from an option into a mandate. All Republicans voted for the bill, except for one. Senator Stuart Greenleaf of Montgomery County voted in the negative. The bill now goes to the House, where it initially was referred to the Urban Affairs Committee. Pakola is trying to get the legislation to Governor Tom Corbett's desk in order to preclude city officials from a potential bankruptcy filing, which he and his allies believe could cause larger credit problems for the region and the state. And the ongoing battle keeps going back and forth on that issue. The mayor has come out and said publicly that there are some things in the Act 47 recommendations that she disagrees with. Thompson said, one, she does not want the city to switch from a two-tier property tax system to one that blends land and building rates because that alone would increase property taxes. Two, she said she does not want to fold the city's Department of Parks and Recreation into the Department of Public Works, but would rather make reductions that could help streamline Department of Parks and Recreation. And three, Thompson also said she is against merging her staff with city council staff, as suggested as a plan because it would create conflict over separation of power as delineated by law.
And how would she get the, how would she force them into fasting, into prayer meetings? And again, you go back to that thing, the Senate thing. Again, how can the Republicans, these local autonomy people, how can they possibly justify what they're doing?
I have some real mixed emotions. I don't like what Pakola's doing on the one hand, but I understand in the big picture, he may be right. Either way they go, it's going to be tough sledding for the city. I understand what he's trying to do is look at the big picture and make sure that this doesn't happen in other cities. On the other hand, what Pakola's plan would do, I think, would protect some of the big investors into the city and allow them not to pay their fair share in the cost. We keep hearing throughout this whole period that they want everybody to share in the cost, and I'm afraid that under Pakola's plan, that's not going to happen. And then we have the workers stand, especially if it goes bankrupt, the workers really stand to lose a lot. And that's my ultimate fear, that the workers who work for this city are really going to take the shaft and certainly share disproportionately in the suffering. And that's the unfortunate thing that could happen. One last story coming out of Harrisburg. Natural gas impact fee vote is pulled from the Pennsylvania House agenda. House Republicans on Tuesday abruptly canceled a vote on an impact fee to produce revenue from Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale natural gas extraction, only ours, after they had announced it would be debated. Majority Whip Stan Saylor from York said the decision was made to buy time until a gubernatorial committee reviewing Marcellus Shale drilling issues reports to Governor Tom Corbett next month. That's a touchy issue. I think there's a lot of Republicans that are taking heat. I think a lot of taxpayers are saying, hey, what's going on here? You're giving these people a free ride. I have misgivings about Governor Corbett's Marcellus Shale Commission. It's stacked, it appears to be stacked heavily on the side of the industry, so I'm not so sure that's a good. It looks like there's a real power game happening behind the scenes. It'll be interesting to see. I think ultimately, Rick, the Republicans are going to be forced to agree to something because they've really been taking a public relations hit on this issue. So it'll be interesting to see if the governor is willing to renege on his pledge.
Read my lips. No new revenue. We're going to have to cut our way out of this. Amazing. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. Stick around. Right back after this.
Drowning in crafty lies, save the USA and resume the ties it binds. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job, join the good
folks. Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1898, 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strikebreakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours, in a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Your working class radio experience.
Where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts
are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich and poverty. For the sun that can be on. Blue denim head is vain. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, right there, you can download it from our website at your convenience, on demand. Take it with you on the go. We will soon have, soon going to have the Stitcher app up for folks to be able to put it on their smartphones as well. So, big news today. Governor Corporate signed the Castle Doctrine, or Governor Castle, if you will, signed the Castle Doctrine, and now you can feel free to basically shoot anyone who threatens you, or you feel threatened by. And I wonder what the standard is. We need to get a lawyer. Now that this is the law of the land, we're going to need to get a lawyer to come out and tell us what's the standard. You know, hey, you know, you look cross-eyed at me. I was worried he might, you know, he might come after me, so I had to take him out before. A little proactive measure there. Kind of like this guy in Eugene, Oregon. Who allegedly shot a co-worker because he was teasing him. The co-worker, you know, was kind of busting his shoes because this guy said, you know, the end of the world's coming May 21st. And, you know, it's that's it. We're all done. And so they busted his shoes. You know, the little ribbing. Hey, you know, what happened to that? What happened to that end of the world thing? Well, I guess it came now because he went and he shot a couple of people. Because they were ribbing him. So good luck in prison. Hope that works out well for you. Again, you know, you got some crazy people. The kind of gun that I, you know, and the next shooting story, kind of one of those guns that you go, I don't know if that's so bad. There was a couple from Ohio. They were, you know, on their way out of town to go to a function. A little wedding, you know, so mama had a little too much to drink. Locked herself. You got a little fight with the husband. Smacked each other around. Called each other some names. So the wife goes, you know what? The heck with you. I'm getting in the car. Lock the doors. So she's Saturday night. She locked herself in the car. Not coming out. Police came. Told her you got to come out of the car. She yelled some interesting pieces of advice at them. Told them what they could go do, and refused to get out of the car. So the deputies, you know, say, well, we're going to have to get her. We're going to have to remove her from the car and get her out and arrest her. As they opened up the car to get her out, can't make this up, In fact, I'm going to quote Sheriff Walter Davis III, who said that when the police approached the car to speak with her, she yelled profanities and refused to get out. He said when deputies attempt to remove Miss Robinette from the vehicle, she advised the deputies that she was a breastfeeding mother and proceeded to remove her right breast from her dress and began spraying deputies with the breast milk. Can't make this up. So there you go. You got one guy, you know, shooting people over being ribbed, and a woman, you know, firing breast milk at a drunken woman with breast milk. Nothing scarier than that. Also, some good news out of Philadelphia and a number of zoos around the country, as we've seen, revenues decline. They've had to come up with some new ways of revenue enhancements. Evidently, now you can go sleep at the zoo. Kids 5 to 12 can have sleepover nights, and they can see how animals act at night. See how they work in a nocturnal world. It's called Roars and Snores Overnight Program. It's been going on for about 20 years at the Philly Zoo. And, of course, kids in 5 to 12 can go there. It costs about $60, so it's a little pricey. But it sounds interesting. Go see the zoo animals. And speaking of zoo animals, evidently Glenn Beck will be leaving the airwaves very soon. But he was talking with Rick Santorum, and I would have liked to have been off camera when they were done having their conversation, because Glenn Beck, evidently, unable to contain himself in talking about the president and Rick Santorum and this whole thing. Beck told Santorum, quote, "I could kiss you in the mouth," while they were holding hands. And Santorum kind of sputtered. He goes, "Well, it's better than," and he sat back in his chair. Now here's the thing. Beck said, "Well, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. You know how those guys do. I don't want to kiss you on the mouth." Isn't that kind of weird? In my life, have you ever said to another man, "Look, I'm not homophobic, but I've never said to another man, what you said has excited me so much I could kiss you on the mouth." I've never said that. Have you ever had that urge? I mean, because I haven't.
No, never.
This guy, this guy's just plain nuts. And maybe, could this be the coming out of the moment, coming out of the closet moment? Could this be where, that whole Glenn Beck thing starts to make sense?
Well, but if you listen to him from the last couple of years, we've been criticizing, but every now and then I see bits and pieces of him. And this is kind of his shtick. He says very controversial things. That's just his personality and his shtick. Maybe that's one of the reasons he's going off TV. I think it is, quite frankly.
Look, I understand.
He does some very controversial things.
I get the whole shtick thing. That, I'm sorry, not part of
it. It's a bit strange.
No, it's not just a bit strange. That's just nuts.
Especially saying that to who he said it to, Mr. Conservative.
Here's the thing. The story kind of goes, the more homophobic someone is, the more chances are that, they kind of lean that way. So maybe Glenn was just opening up an opportunity. Because Tricky Ricky's probably one of the most homophobic people out there. So maybe Glenn said, "Hey, I'll throw out this little gaydar and see if Ricky bites on it, like the ice cream cone." There's an interesting picture of Rick Santorum going down on an ice cream cone. interesting stuff. Anyway, I want to thank everyone who on the program this evening. Our friend from Philadelphia, Luigi Borda. LuigiGetsAround.com, guy who ran from Philadelphia here to Harrisburg. I got to give him credit. Dedication. Sounds like a good guy. Miss Pagic from Wisconsin, the grad student and TAA co-president there, about the information. Good stuff. I'm excited about these recall elections in Wisconsin. Anyway, tomorrow on the agenda, we're going to be talking about the school voucher stuff. That seems to be what's going to be on the plate for tomorrow. Maybe some more budget stuff, some more information around the clock. The debt talks still going on. The hostage crisis still in full tilt. Your calls, of course, as always. And again, if you want to contact me, Rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Call River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well,